Good evening. We'll call the meeting to order and ask the clerk to read the roll.
Mike Polakoff's excused. Michael Serpy?
Here.
Wayne Kessel will be late. Deb Scarta?
Here.
Jim Bandura?
Here.
Judy Giuliana?
Here.
Bill Stobig?
Here.
John Skalbeck?
Here.
Brock Williamson?
Here.
Quorum present. Correspondence, Jean?
I have none this evening.
Okay. Citizens' comments. Every item on the agenda tonight is a public hearing, so if there's something that you wish to address this commission on, you can wait till that item is called. But if there's anything else that anybody wishes to speak that's not on the agenda, now would be your time to address this commission. We'd ask that you give your name and address when you approach the microphone. And whoever talks tonight, please talk close to the microphone so everybody can be heard with their comments so we can properly record it. Anybody wishing to speak? Anybody wishing to speak? We'll close citizens' comments, open up item A, new business. Public hearing and consideration of a master conceptual plan. Jean?
Trustee Serpy, members of the Plan Commission in the audience, item A is a public hearing and consideration of a master conceptual plan, and this is at the request of Mark Eberle, P.E., with Nielsen, Matson & Barber, on behalf of Bronco Dupanjek, owner of the vacant properties located at 7821 120th Avenue, for the development of two commercial buildings and associated site improvements. The northern lot is proposed to be developed as a Hyatt Place Hotel or other similar franchise with banquet hall and restaurant. The southern property is proposed to be developed as the Kings and Convicts Brewery with a restaurant, brew house, cellar tanks, and packaging area, game rooms, private lounges, and meeting areas. The developer is requesting then approval of a master conceptual plan, and this is for the development of 7.4 acres of vacant land, which is south of State Trunk Highway 50 on the east side of 120th Avenue, known as the East Frontage Road. This is for a commercial and manufacturing development of a hotel, conference facility, and a brewery. The 5.7 acre site combined with the adjacent 1.7 acre site, which is currently being purchased from the Wisconsin DOT, is proposed to be developed with a Hyatt Place Hotel or similar franchise and a Kings and Convicts Brewing Company. With respect to the hotel is planned to have 124 rooms with an 8,214 square foot private suite area with three rooms on the fifth floor. The main floor of the hotel will include a lobby and reception area, restaurant and bar area, banquet and meeting rooms, kitchen and pool area. Additional banquet facilities with a terrace area will also be located on the fifth floor. Pursuant to the application, it is anticipated that the hotel will employ about 20 employees, but that does not include the restaurant, the banquet facilities, or any other additional employees that may be needed. Again, it's important to note that we are presenting a concept plan that's showing both the hotel complex and the brewery, but at this time we are focusing more on the Kings and Convicts Brewery with respect to the details for the project. So the Kings and Convicts Brewery, the name Kings and Convicts derives from the two founders' heritage, an Englishman, the King, and an Australian, the Convict, who reside on the shores of Lake Michigan with access to some of the best brewing water in the world in a town that has rich immigrant history with an undercurrent of anti-authority and the love of the scoundrel. The foundation of the brand's personality is the love of great beer, a fun anti-authority approach to marketing, and the rich immigrant tapestry of U.S., England, and Australia. Great liquid and a great story with beers that appear to the growing craft beer market. The brand name represents who they are. It is memorable and it's different. This brand enables growth outside of the local markets with the ultimate goal to expand the brand regionally, then ultimately nationwide and internationally. The history and the beer styles translate across the U.S. and will flourish in Australia, the U.K., New Zealand, and Asia. The beer names capture a sense of American, English, and Australian history that provides a deep well from which to draw in terms of the marketing and beer styles. the new brewery, taproom and patio, event center, and brig will ensure that the essence of the brand is enhanced and carried throughout the customer experience. The exterior building will highlight the rich history of kings sending convicts to Australia. The exterior landscape at the back of the building will incorporate natural prairie grasslands of the region. The interior design will ensure that the brewery is always on display, that the experience is real, and the space is appealing and comfortable, yet rugged. The brew house and the cellar tanks will be visible from I-94 on the west side of the property through the large arched windows and taproom, restaurant, and event space, which will face east and overlook the natural areas of the Kilbourne Ditch and associated wetlands and the Des Plaines floodplain. For the brewery, the automated brew house will be the focal point, situated behind the taproom bar, with the towering fermenters standing immediately behind, holding the attention of the patrons. The fermentation tanks will be on display internally and externally, glazed walls and lights highlighting the stainless steel. Kings and Convicts Brewing Company is investing in a brand new state-of-the-art brew house and cellar. This $2 million system is being designed and manufactured in Wisconsin by QTS Tanks. They will be brewing a range of ales, lagers, and pilsners for sale in the taproom and via distribution into Wisconsin and the Midwest. The taproom will have several key sections, including a bar area with high tops and bar seating, dining area with classic table seating, communal picnic table seating, a lounge area with more relaxed, comfortable seating, and a patio with fire pits, outdoor seating, and family seating area. The food, classic American fare served by the kitchen, including burgers, tacos, and pizza. An outdoor barbecue and smoke pit will be on the patio adjacent to the tap room. Aussie meat pies and English fish and chips will also be available periodically. The event center, a 250-capacity event center on the second floor, overlooking the Des Plaines River and adjoining the tap room. The brig is a 50-person capacity room adjacent to the tap room that has access to the fermentation area with a brewing-focused feel will be a feature of the brig aimed at corporate and smaller events. This room will be capable of holding smaller gatherings that is more private yet retains the essence of the brewing experience. Hours, brewery operations will be approximately be from 5 o'clock a.m. to 5 o'clock p.m. Monday through Friday. The tap room will be open from 11 o'clock a.m. to 12 o'clock a.m. 7 days a week. Estimated daily truck trips. Brewery operations will require the delivery of goods and ingredients and the removal of finished product and waste products. The taproom and event space will require food deliveries. In total, it's estimated that about for the truck trips, it will average about 4 or 6 per day under their full operation. Under employment, in the production area, they will have between 13 and 25 full and part-time staff. The taproom, kitchen, and event space will generate 70 to 90 full and part-time jobs for a total of 83 to 115 jobs on the site. Type of materials and equipment to be stored on the site. Raw materials for the production and packaging of their beers includes ingredients, which is hops, grains, and yeast, packaging materials, cans, trays, and kegs, cleaning materials for their equipment, and production materials such as carbon dioxide tanks and oxygen tanks. On-site equipment includes brewing equipment, cellar tanks for fermentation, canning and kegging lines for packaging finished goods, CO2 and O2 tanks, and forklifts. The tap room will have a kitchen with ingredients dedicated to cold and dry storage. The primary solid waste from the production of beer is spent grain. They will be installing a spent grain silo to capture 100% of the grain used in the production. This grain will be physically removed from the site and used for feed for local farms. Yeast and hops are the two solid waste products and will both be disposed off-site again with local farmers and organic recycling providers. Their primary objective with water is reuse and recycling. They will have several systems in place to capture water used in the brewing and cleaning of their tanks. The remaining water waste will be routed into the sanitary sewer system. Village liquor licenses for selling and consuming alcohol will be required for each use. In addition, State of Wisconsin Department of Revenue permits for the brewery and wholesale sales of beer will also be required. Now, with respect to site access and parking, as seen on the slide, although the hotel and the brewery sites may be subdivided into two parcels, they will share common access, parking, and will be developed as a unified development. Two access points will be provided to the development from 120th Avenue or the East Frontage Road, as allowed and permitted by the Wisconsin DOT. A transportation impact analysis, or TIA, is in process, and they actually, as of yesterday, they just agreed on trip generation formulas with the DOT, and the formal submittal of the TIA is going into the DOT tomorrow. All required off-site improvements to 120th Avenue will be outlined in a Memorandum of Understanding known as an MOU between the Wisconsin DOT and the village. The developer will have a corresponding agreement with the village to financially guarantee the construction of the 120th Avenue improvements. Cross-access will be provided between and through the properties. The entire site provides for 492 parking spaces, including 16 handicapped accessible parking spaces. Parking allocated to the brewery building is 114 parking spaces, including 8 handicapped accessible spaces. And the parking allocated to the hotel is 376 parking spaces. The amount of parking is still being further evaluated to make sure that there is adequate on-site parking. If for some reason we have a final determination as we get through the final site and operational planning that any additional parking is needed, the staff will be working with them to evaluate whether or not any underground parking is available or visible or possible, I should say, for the hotel. For municipal services, public sanitary sewer and water will be required to be extended to serve this development in 120th Avenue. The developer will be responsible to pay for their fair share to utilize the Chateau lift station in the amount of $23,546.26. There's a village engineer memo that addresses this. This will be required to be paid prior to the issuance of any building permits. In addition, the Wisconsin DOT will require additional roadway improvements within the frontage road. The village will draft the required development agreement to be entered into that sets forth the required public and private improvements and outlines the financial security, including the above-noted lift station fee, to ensure that all the work is completed. A certified survey map will be required to show any land division, any additional right-of-way, and any additional easements, dedications, and restrictive covenants. The CSM shall be, at a minimum, showing all of the following easements and other noted items. And again, as you know, I typically draft that language once we get a little bit further with respect to the detailed engineering and CSM plans. And that includes stormwater drainage, retention basin, access and maintenance easement areas, signage, access and maintenance areas, dedicated ingress, egress, cross-access, cross-parking maintenance areas, dedicated wetland preservation and protection areas, as well as dedicated general utility areas. A comprehensive land use plan map amendment will be required to correctly show the location of any wetlands on the properties. Zoning map and zoning text amendments will be required to create the required plan development or PD ordinance and to rezone any wetlands into the C1 Lowland Resource Conservancy District. All of the wetlands have been delineated on the properties already. The PD ordinance will allow the village to create an ordinance that outlines specific uses and requirements for the development. Under their site and operational plans, they will be required for each individual building. That includes the site plans, drainage and grading plans, building plans, landscape plans, industrial waste survey, signage, and any other plans and documents pursuant to the site and operational plan requirements of the village ordinance. Each building will also be required to comply with the village's digital security imaging system, or DSIS system, pursuant to Chapter 410 of our ordinance. Site and operational plans will need to be identical to the state-approved plans when we get to that point. Further discussion is warranted to determine whether or not they are going to do a preliminary site and operational plan, then a final, in order to begin mass grading earlier than obtaining their building permit for the site. In addition, prior to the issuance of any permits, an airport overlay site plan review approval from the City of Kenosha is required because of their proximity or distance to the Kenosha Regional Airport. So with that, are we doing the video first? I could introduce the guys from Kings and Convicts to add some additional flair for their presentation regarding the brewery and the concept. We also have a video that they would like to show you.
Okay.
So maybe we'll start with the video.
Do we have somebody, do we have a representative?
Yeah.
Please, just name an address for the record.
Brendan Waters, and address? Yeah, 1071 Valley Road in Lake Forest.
Chris Bradley, 688 Buena Road, Lake Forest.
So part of what we wanted to do here was have a building that represented from the roadway. You can see all the tanks. So when you're driving by, that you don't, you know, you come up, it makes a statement. It makes a statement about the brand, but it also has some design aspects in this that are reflective also of the old gunpowder factory. So when you're going to be inside this, it will be an industrial feel, but a warm feel, and somewhere that you can come and stay and enjoy having a beer and having something to eat. But we wanted to make an impact from the exterior, so that it's a destination. I think the other part to this for us also is, you know, having access, you know, great access off the interstate, but also off State Highway 50, somewhere that it's easy in and out, and it's easy for locals to get to, but also when people drive by, when you're going up and down I-94, people will understand that this is Pleasant Prairie's brewery, and while there are other, you know, good breweries around, and we know a lot of them around Kenosha and up from Milwaukee down to Chicago, we wanted to do things a little bit differently. So there's not a lot like this around, and this is not something new. We've based a lot of the design elements of this from some of the really good breweries that we've seen out in California, in Minnesota, and in Texas, and we decided that if we're going to do this, we're going to do it big.
Very unique design. You have to be a convict to get a job there?
What's that? We'll have to think about that one. So the convict elements, I'll bring in some convicts, but we'll make sure that they're all under control.
Okay.
But yeah, so this is just some of conceptual drawings there, and some of what we'll see in the tap room itself. Part of this, that what we wanted to do is have separate areas that people can come and enjoy it, and some of the local community can come and have some space that's separate. But one of the things that's driven us nuts about the small place we have at the moment and some of the other breweries is we never want to have the tap room shut down for people to come and have time to sit down and enjoy a beer. Sometimes when you have these events, you lock down the whole tap room, and that means that it's only for private events. Everything that we've done here in trying to design this is to have separate areas that through all seasons locals and guests can come in and enjoy some good barbecue and a good beer and watch things that are going on. But that doesn't preclude from renting out some of the space and having some corporate events or whatever we want to do in there. So it's going to be a multi-use facility. But what we really wanted to do was make sure that the brewing is always on display, so that it is a true destination to come and see how beer is made.
What is your comparison food to beverage? What is it? Do you have an idea?
You mean in split in terms of revenue?
Yeah, more food than beverage.
It'll be more food than beverage. This is a brewery that we'll distribute outside of. People can take to go, so there'll be a retail area there. But there will likely be more food than beverage.
Okay. Anything else?
No, unless there are other questions.
Is this the first in your development of Kings and Convicts, or is this part of a
chain? We have a small one. Our first one is actually in Highwood, Illinois, so just on the lake down there with access to the water. So the water is a big deal for us, having access to Lake Michigan water. And so we have our first one, and it's a production brewery, but smaller. and a very tiny taproom. And so that was always one of our first goals, is to get it up and going, start developing the brand, developing the recipes, getting it out there into the market. And then we've spent the better part of the last 9 months, 12 months, trying to find the right spot. And the right spot found us. So that's why we're here.
You mentioned the powder plant.
Yep.
What are you going to do to highlight that on the interior?
So inside, there's going to be stories. Everything, so a little bit of, with Kings and Convicts, we believe that every beer tells a story. Every single one of our beers tells a story about English sending convicts to Australia, or some of the undercurrent of anti-authority thugs that are here in the United States. We plan on also telling stories on the wall with murals, as well as tours. So we're going to have tours all the time that go and tell the story of beer, the Kings and Convicts, and our location. Just so happens that the powder plant also has some design elements of old wood and old industrial look, so we plan on telling the story of the powder plant in this as well.
Good.
Will your private events be able to house the weddings?
Yes.
Receptions?
Oh. Yes.
Okay. Jean, do you have anything else?
I don't think so. Okay, at this point, I mean, we're at the conceptual plan stage at this point. So we are working through lots of details with them at this point. So they are looking for positive direction from the plan commission and the board that everyone agrees that this is a good use for this location. Again, if you look at the drawing that Peggy just put up, all of the land to the east of this facility basically is part of the Des Plaines River Conservancy. And land, you can see the curve in the road as that 108 turns into 118th Avenue as it goes north towards Highway 50. And then there is a single-family home currently immediately to the south. And then after that, then it's conservancy land as well.
Okay.
Again, this is all part of the regional powder plant land area. And a lot of the land that's immediately adjacent was donated to the Village of Pleasant Prairie, 200 or 300 acres that were donated several years ago, and so there's a large conservancy area between here and then the nearest subdivisions, which are Chateau and River Oaks to the east.
Gene.
Okay. This is, we have a public hearing.
Go ahead. Just a quick question. The parcel that's on the north side of the curve, is that going with this, or?
So where their parking lot is located?
Right.
The north side of the curve?
Or the
north side of the curve, yes.
Sorry. No, that's going to be owned and retained by the Wisconsin DOT. It's primarily all floodplain wetland.
That's what I thought. Okay.
You want to open this up, Gene? You ready? Okay, this is a matter for public hearing. Anybody wishing to speak? Anybody wishing to speak? We'll close the public hearing and open up the comments and questions if you have any others from the commission.
Got a question to Matt. Isn't that the lift station from there to the lift station, how far is that? Is that really going to work?
The lift station that this sewage will go to is the lift station in Chateau.
Right
there. So there's a sanitary sewer that goes across that environmental corridor. So it goes across the creek and out to the frontage road, kind of, I'd say just south of the development by Highway 50, and they'll be taking that south as much as they can. And there's actually, it looks like a conflict with the pipe, so they'll be taking their sewage with either a grinder pump or sanitary sewer and taking it to that existing sanitary sewer line that goes to the lift station.
So you are going to cross the creek there then?
There is a sanitary sewer that already crosses the creek.
Anybody else? What's your pleasure?
If there aren't any questions from the commission, I recommend approval.
Second.
Motion made and seconded for approval of the master conceptual plan. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, yes, have it. Looking forward to this very interesting project. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Item B, public hearing and consideration of a master conceptual plan for Kevin Risch.
Okay.
Item B is a consideration of a master conceptual plan for the request of Kevin Bush with Clark Dietz, agent, on behalf of Prairie Holdings, LLC, owner of the vacant property east of 9201 Wilmot Road. The property is located within the M1 Limited Manufacturing District and is proposed to be subdivided for the development of 3 limited-use industrial-related buildings and associated site improvements. Lot 2 is proposed to be developed as extra space storage building. The other two properties have no proposed users at this time, but are shown as potential building sites. And as you can see, the large building on the site, that is 9201 Wilmot Road, so this is actually to the north-northeast, and that is at the intersection of Highway C and Highway H on the west side of the village. The developer is requesting approval of a master conceptual plan for the development of the vacant 17.6 acres of land located east of 9201 Wilmot Road at the southwest corner of H and C for a limited manufacturing development. The property is currently zoned M1, limited manufacturing. It's proposed to be subdivided into 3 parcels for limited use industrial buildings and associated improvements. Lot 2 is proposed to be developed, and that is the secondary purpose of the request this evening, is to show you the extra space storage building, which is an indoor climate control building. The 2 other properties have no proposed users at this time, but are shown as potential building site areas. On October 2nd, 2017, the village approved a certified survey map and an associated memorandum of understanding, an MOU, for the owner to subdivide the property so that the existing 9201 Wilmot Road building would remain on one property and vacant land to the east could be located on a separate property. The owner has removed a large, unused parking lot to the east of the building and install the required stormwater retention system and other site improvements for the existing industrial development. It was the intent of the developer that the remaining vacant land with a private driveway access to fire station number 2 would be further developed for light industrial purposes. So if you're looking at the master conceptual plan, now it's kind of turned a little bit. So on the very north end is the 9201 Wilmot building. The lot 2 is what we're going to be getting into a little bit more detail about tonight, and that's the extra space storage. And then lot 1, lot 3 are the proposed new buildings, and then fire station number 2 exists adjacent to 88th Avenue. To the west of the vacant building is an existing 22.34-acre property with a 385,000-square-foot industrial building being used primarily for warehousing and storage. To the east is Fire Station 2. On the east side of 88th Avenue is the southern entrance to Westwood Mobile Home Park, a few scattered single-family homes, and the Hidden Oak Apartments. To the north along Highway C are single-family residential homes and the Pleasant Prairie Elementary School, and to the south is Kenosha Groundscare. This vacant land is proposed to be further subdivided, as indicated, into 3 parcels, and these would be zoned M1 Limited Manufacturing Zoning District. Lot 1 is proposed to be 3.7 acres, and it could be developed with a 14,112-square-foot building. At this time, no proposed user has been identified, but the property has been laid out for this potential type of light industrial development. Again, to give everyone an idea of what could develop if it does develop on the property. Then lot 2 is proposed to be 6.2 acres for the development of a 127,000-square-foot warehouse building proposed to be occupied by extra space storage. Again, it's a climate-controlled, basically mini-storage building. Lot 3 is proposed to be 7.7 acres, and it could be developed with a 43,500-square-foot building. No user has been identified for this property, but again, it's been laid out for a light industrial development. The lots will not have any direct driveway access to Highway H or Highway C. They will have direct through private access through, they will have access through private roadways that will connect to H and C. The primary access will be through an existing north-south private drive that currently services the needs of the fire station. So you can see on the arrows that there's one access off of Wilmot Road, and then the other access is off 88th Avenue, which is Highway H. So that which Peggy just highlighted in yellow, that is like the main private private roadway that connects everyone and gets access to all the lots, including the fire station as a secondary access. The private roadway will connect with an east-west private road that will connect to the existing access on the property to the west, which has an access to C as well. So what Peggy's just outlined is that there's a western access in yellow, and then again that connects up to C. And then privately, there's a drive that connects to the east as well that goes to the village's water tower that's on that location as well. All the private roadways on this vacant land area will be reconstructed with curb and gutter, paving, storm sewer drainage systems, roadway lighting, all to service the three lots while continuing to service the fire station. All buildings will be required to connect to municipal water and sewer within the adjacent private streets. The development of the property will also require the installation of two additional retention basins to ensure that adequate stormwater management is being provided for the development. The developer intends to grade the properties, construct the stormwater basins, and install all stormwater improvements and sewer and water improvements associated with the private roadways. So he's trying to get these sites all pad ready. The village will draft an addendum to the existing MOU for the remaining site improvements, which again includes private roads, streetlights, grading, and storm basins, and will require additional financial security to be provided to ensure that these improvements are completed. Upon approval of the master conceptual plan, detailed site development plans, a revised CSM, and documents to vacate any existing easements that are no longer needed, will need to be submitted for review and approval so an addendum can be drafted and the CSM can be finalized. The certified survey map, easement vacation documents, and the MOU addendum will be considered by the Plan Commission and the Board at the same time at a subsequent meeting. There are some wetlands within Lot 3 that have been determined by the Wisconsin DNR to be artificial wetlands. Pursuant to their letter that's attached as dated August 8, 2018, the petitioner is waiting for confirmation from the Army Corps of Engineers to determine whether or not they'll be taking jurisdiction, or they could also apply for fill permits from the Army Corps of Engineers. Prior to any grading of the site, all required approvals from the Army Corps shall be obtained and submitted to the village. A comprehensive land use plan map amendment and zoning map amendment will be required to correctly show the location of any wetlands that will remain on the properties. So on Lot 2, the proposed use for conceptual purposes will be identified as extra space storage. And Lot 2 is proposed to be sold, and extra space storage facility is proposed to be constructed. The storage building will be approximately 127,000 square foot building. Within the building, there'll be 1,000 square foot office area and climate controlled storage units. And their variety in size is shown on the screen. Might be a little hard to read, but they will be from 5 by 5 feet to the largest, which is 30 by 10. So 25 feet to 300 square feet in the area. All storage units are located inside the climate control building. All persons and businesses that may rent a storage unit would access the building in their vehicle through an overhead door on the north side of the building. Upon entering, the overhead garage door will close and the customer will continue to drive through the large center aisle to the appropriate storage aisle to unload or retrieve items from their units and exit the building on the south. So what this means is that there is no access to the storage units from the outside of the building. The building and the site is monitored with camera systems, and the exterior of the site will be monitored pursuant to the village's security ordinance with the DSIS, or the Digital Security Imaging System, pursuant to Chapter 410 of the code. The precast panel building will provide for windows and a metal entry feature at the main office entry and by the required exterior man door fire exits from the building. Additional architectural details have been provided. I'm not sure if they're all included on these photos, but they've started to provide some additional details for us for the building. The facility will employ 1 to 2 full-time employees and would expect about 10 trips from their customers a day. A total of 11 parking spaces, including one accessible parking space, will be provided adjacent to the office area of the building, which is adjacent to Highway C. With respect to site and operational plans, they will be required for each individual building that includes the site plans, drainage, grading, building, landscape, signage, and all other plans as required by the site and operational plan provisions. Further discussion is also warranted with this development. I'm not sure if they're going to do it in two steps, bringing a preliminary site and operational plan first and then a final. Again, oftentimes businesses bring the preliminary along with the detailed civil plans, grading plans, building footprint plans in order to begin mass grading to take advantage of a spring start and installation of underground site utilities and footing and foundation, but that's going to be up to the petitioner to determine whether or not they want to complete the improvements prior to get some of the improvements completed prior to submitting for building permit. Either way, an addendum to the MOU does need to be prepared, needs to be detailed. We do need to have financial security, and we need to have all of those details in place along with the schedule of when the work is going to be completed so that the village can determine exactly how far extra space storage can go prior to work being developed on their site, because we need to have municipal sanitary sewer and water connections and roadway connections to their site for them to be able to adequately construct on the site. So with that, this is a public hearing. I'd like to introduce extra space storage or the developer of the property or the engineer, whoever would like to come up to make a further presentation with respect to the site. Again, the staff has vetted this out from an overreaching large-scale conceptual standpoint because there are potential for three other lots to be created. We have been in constant communication with the fire department and the fire chief to make sure that anything that is done here will not compromise anything that we have going on with respect to being able to provide fire protection. So we will be working continually with them to make sure that there's always adequate access in and out of the fire station from that private road. So with that, I'm not sure who of the petitioner would like to come up to make a part of a presentation or answer any questions first.
And we'll need your name and address for the record as well.
Good evening. My name is Kevin Risch. I reside at 8308 47th Avenue here in Pleasant Prairie.
And I am Bruno Haney. My wife and I, Lori, she's in the audience here. We reside at 12138 North River Road in Mequon, Wisconsin. We're the owners and developers.
Rich Pipek, 4423 North Morris Boulevard in Shorewood, Wisconsin. I'm the architect working with the development team here for the extra space storage addition.
I'm the engineer on record for the facility at hand. All three sites are planned to be mass graded at the same time. Clark Dietz prepared the grading and roadway plans for all three of the sites, as well as the site to the west, the large facility where we incorporated two retention ponds as part of that site. Where the existing site is right now, lot two, that was a ginormous parking lot that was dilapidated. The owner, at the wish of the staff, removed it and then replaced it with engineered fill for the expectation that this was going to be further developed. So most of the material that we took out for the retention ponds was retained on site. We reutilized the material for future use. And the same thing is going to be done with this facility. The pond that's at the corner by the roundabout, as well as the pond by lot three, both those ponds will be dug at the same time. At least that's the intent. And then all material that's being removed from there is going to remain on site. We have very little haul material that's going to come off site if we mass grade it all together. At the same time, as Gene already alluded to, we plan on putting all the stormwater required pipe in the roadways in advance of Lot 3, Lot 1, and Lot 2. Overall, the intent is to try to coincide the mass grading submittal with probably a preliminary or maybe 60% plans for the extra space storage so that the owner can take advantage of the mass grading contractor to do his underground work, put his underground pipes in, at the same time for cost savings. The unique thing about the Lot 2 extra space storage, you'll probably take note there are no retention ponds on that facility. The way we designed that facility is we took all the stormwater off of that property via roof drains into stormwater through, and that will reach Lot 1 retention pond. We needed two lots of retention ponds because of the site topography and elevations. So primarily the south pond by Lot 3 will be used primarily by that site. The other two are going to be utilizing the one that's near the roundabout. So that is the intent is to get approval for this master conceptual plan so that we can develop final plans for the roadway and mass grading at the same time that the owner of Lot 2 moves through his renderings and required plans for city development.
Okay. Gene, anything else before we open it up? Okay. This is a matter for public hearing. Anybody wishing to speak? Anybody wishing to speak? We'll close the public. Gene?
I do have a letter that I received that they would like to have me read into the public record.
Go ahead.
As part of the public hearing comments. And it was received by the staff on January 23rd, 2019. Dear members of the Pleasant Prairie Plan Commission, my name is Andrew Ewell, and I live at 9100 Wilmot Road. I am unable to attend tonight's meeting regarding the proposed self-storage warehouse across from my house on Highway C. I was informed that letters would be read at the meeting, and I would like to express my concerns with the proposed warehouse. I've been a resident of Pleasant Prairie since 1996, and my wife has been living in this house for the past 42 years. We purchased her parents' home 17 years ago when they purchased it in 1970. When they bought the house, it was farmland and residential all the way down Highway C. Then Tri-Clover building was built in 1973. I know the current Planning Commission did not have anything to do with it being there, but they do have some control and guidance with respect to development around it. All will admit the Tri-Clover building is out of place with the village's master plan. And I remember of all the talks of wanting it torn down for residential development. It is residential on both sides of Highway H and all the way down Wilmot Road to the interstate. The village has tried to keep this a similar residential county road and has banned semi-traffic from the Tri-Clover building west on C. With the renovation of the Tri-Clover building, semi-traffic has greatly expanded, allowed to be used from the east, but they still sneak down Wilmot from the interstate occasionally. There has been much done to the property by the new owners, and the landscaping does look better. But now they're proposing a warehouse. One was bad enough, so now let's build three more. If you look at the proposal, Lot 2, which is supposed to be developed first, the square footage of the building takes almost the entire property. Very little grass and landscaping and no retention pond for runoff and closer to the road than its warehouse neighbor to the west. Lots 1 and 3 have much smaller building footprints compared to the lot, with more landscaping and retention areas. These buildings at this time are only proposals. I'm asking the Commission to please understand, while a building like this may be a good addition to the village, it's not across from your house. And it's not that you will see your property value decrease. It's not you will get to look out at a 127,000-square-foot green-trimmed storage warehouse. And it's not that you have to put up with the difficulties in leaving your driveway due to increased traffic. It's already dangerous to walk out and get your mail. If this proposal was across from River Oaks or Prairie Ridge, it wouldn't probably be approved. Please consider a smaller building, more landscaping, and a bigger berm with no green neon trim. Please consider the residents of the village that have to live across from the warehouse. Thank you for your time, Andrew Ewell and family.
Thanks.
So I'd like to have the petitioner respond to this. A couple of things that I do need to make the plan commissioners aware of, and I think most of you know, that at one point this area was supposed to be Pleasant Prairie's Industrial Park. So when Tri-Clover went in 73 and expansions in 78, really this area back in 84 was all put into a manufacturing district. So we did not take that manufacturing zoning away in 2010 with the comprehensive plan because it was vested to that property. So it is a limited or light manufacturing area. But what I can say is this is a mini storage facility. It's not an exterior accessed facility. It's an inside facility. They will have very, very, very little traffic, very little truck traffic, because unless you're moving, you could rent a 300-square-foot unit, but you actually have to come in through a garage door. The door shuts behind you. So it's not like there'll be a lot of traffic generated because storage units typically are not visited every day, every week, every month, and sometimes not every year, depending on what people are storing there. And so when the staff saw this particular use, there are a lot of residents in this area, a lot of businesses. There are people who live in apartments in this area. So a lot of people could use some extra storage. And out of all the other mini storage products that we have seen recently, with respect to having all the doors on the outside and having to do a lot of additional fencing and so on and so forth, we welcomed an opportunity to work with one that was a little bit more considerate to the abutting neighborhood and the amount of traffic that could be coming to a particular site. So I don't know if the owners, we are still working with them. This was with respect to some design elements and things like that. For this particular site, but again, it's not intended to be a high traffic generating use with a lot of bright lights or anything like that. Inside the facility, it will be very bright, but not on the exterior of the facility. And it's a service that could be used by the local residents and businesses.
Anything to add on that?
Well, I think Gina's right. The building has very, very little traffic. There's a manager and an assistant manager that are there during the day. If somebody wants a unit, they typically reserve it on their smartphone or by their computer, come in. They get a passcode to enter the building. You do enter the building with high-speed doors. They go up very, very quickly. You drive in, and they shut very quickly. And there's LED in-motion lighting in there. Typically, it's not when people vacate the building, all the lights go off as you exit the building. There's jazz music playing inside there. The floors are polished daily. So this is a very, very clean business that we operate, and there is very little traffic. Typically, there's the manager's car that's parked outside, and that's it. It's once the building is sustained, It's kind of like watching grass grow. There's just not much that happens there. People come in, door shut, they exit out the back, and that's it. So it's a very, very professionally run business, very quiet, and very, very clean.
Thank you.
Just a quick one. Are you set on the lime green color?
Yes. That's Extra Space is our third-party management company, and they have just under 2,000 locations nationwide. And when people first see that, they said, wow, when you look at it on the computer screen, but this will be our third facility that we've developed and are running. And actually a lot of the public, and even coming back for conditional uses into some of the municipalities, now that they're up and they have just raved about how nice and how nice they look. They were actually pleasantly surprised from being a conceptual to an actual piece of property developed, and they actually raved about it, how nice it looked in their community. Okay. And that was the town of Grafton.
Let me ask for anybody wish to speak. Anybody wish to speak on this? We'll close the public hearing. Okay. Brock?
What are your hours of operation?
Typically for the manager arrives at 9:30 and to 7 p.m., but typically people can come in, I believe, at about 6 or 7 a.m., and then we're closed at 10 p.m. So we don't have any traffic at night. Everything's lowly lit. It's actually a hotel feel is the best way to describe the property.
That's what I was going to ask. So you'll go mostly dark at night?
Well,
safety-wise, but not like showing it off as a...
daylight. We are not showing off the property. It is very low lit, very soft lighting. It doesn't stand out. We're not there to advertise and, you know, get the big pops. People that are, it's their business too, the renters. So everybody takes pride in this. And it's the best way to describe it is really just a soft hotel feel. And that's it without the traffic.
And then how do you restrict what's stored there?
There's contracts, that the customers have to sign. So there's no motor vehicles, no paints, no hazardous material. And, so it's typically household goods or a lot of the businesses, some of the hospitals utilize our facilities also. They store some of their, you know, bedding, that type of thing in there because it is climate controlled. So it's heated, air conditioned. So it's a really nice, like today's a perfect day for it.
Is it? It's going to be sprinkler too, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
What's the rent range per unit?
It really depends on for the area, for the price. Corporate sets all the prices, but for like a smaller 5x5, they can be low as $29 a month. Okay. Up to a 10x30 can be several hundred dollars a month.
Okay. So I want to go back to Brock's question, though. So, or I don't know, maybe Jim asked it, but the neon green is like a corporate color that you have to stay with, or can there be subtle changes in that?
It's a standard. It's a standard across the country, in fact, across the world.
I'll interject just a little bit that our rendering probably shows it a little bit brighter than it maybe truly is. I mean, we'll have full samples for the full site and operations used to show you the true color versus what's showing up.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Pleasant Prairie sign. I'm trying to figure out if it's closer to the green on that, or is it like
closer to the? That's a good, very good example. It would be closer to the Pleasant Prairie sign. So it's a very welcoming, especially with the colors. You've got almost an LED look that I'm seeing it because we've built these before, and it looks very bright, very jumping out at you. But once the building is up with the colors, the tones that we have, it actually is wow. This is a beautiful building.
Right.
It's not. What is that? It's a gorgeous building.
Just
and that's what we have a trend, so it's not a new concept. And there's, again, I believe just 1,700 to 2,000 locations nationwide.
Okay. Just trying to avoid the Mr. Yup color green.
Is there another exit other than the overhead door?
The entry it would be the big high-speed door,
yeah.
And you drive right down through the center, and you can pull off to the side so people can pass you. On the inside, and then you exit out the back.
Right. Is there any other
mandatory
foot traffic doors that people can enter? Or if the doors don't work, are they able to get out?
Oh, yeah, certainly. There's several emergency exits in the building. And then at the front door in the office, you can go through into the office and then transition right into the warehouse from there through a vestibule.
Okay.
The entry doors, the roll-up doors, what size are they going to be?
We're looking at between like a 16 to 20 foot wide door by 14 high, I believe.
Okay.
Right. And they're high speed. So what's really interesting, until you see one of these doors, it's probably one of the coolest. What I like to show off is when you hit a button, it's almost they're air driven. So they don't go like a standard garage door and you have to sit there and wait. When you hit the button, punch in your code, the doors actually fly up. As fast as you can blink, the doors go up, you drive in, and the doors come right down behind you. So they're not open. There's nothing to look at inside other than polished, clean. Our inside, the interiors are all stark white. It's a very, very clean atmosphere that we uphold.
Where's the closest one of these facilities?
I believe the closest facility might be Franklin. We don't own that one, though.
Gurney, too.
Gurney.
Anything else?
I'm just kind of curious what you're planning as far as the landscaping. I mean, I want to take into account Mr. Yule's comments about the, you know, landscaping.
Well, I think it's kind of conceptual now, right?
Right.
Yeah. So
it is, in fact, conceptual because I've got a lot of comments in my staff comments on the color, the height variations, some painting elements, the landscaping, and they've assured me, you know, when we get to the next level, the preliminary site and operational or the final, that we will see all of those details and hopefully we'll address a lot of the concerns with respect to the appearance. They have indicated to us that they like to over-landscape the building, and so that's what we're going to be looking for is over-landscaping. This is going to be developed as part of a unified business development, and in doing so, that's why the stormwater basin for this site, there's three stormwater basins that are servicing these three lots. There isn't one specifically on lot two because basins have a tendency to want to be in the lowest areas, so this is being developed as a unified development. But in answer to your question about the green, yes, I have some reservations and concerns, and so we have some discussions to go through with them in order to maybe tone down a little bit of that facing to the west, as well as to add some additional elements, knowing of the proximity of where this building is located.
Okay, thanks, Gene.
Gene, question to the staff. The fire chief is okay with the circulation around the station? I know this is conceptual, but...
So it exists that way today. So when the fire department goes out on a call, they go out, and then they come around to the back, and then they can come down Highway C. They can come right in the back of the station, and so all the rigs are then facing east. So they use that circulation. And so that private roadway, which is, again, from Wilmot Road to 88th Avenue, that's the way it exists. It's been that way since the early 70s, and it works just fine for the fire department. The key is during construction, it has to be able to continue to function so they can get in and then get their rigs facing to the east on 88th Avenue.
And he doesn't see any conflicts there?
No, not at all. That's the way it's been operating for 40, 50 years, and they really like the way it works, especially with the bigger rigs that
we
have.
I'm just thinking of the increased traffic or whatever.
Again, there's really not going to be much traffic at this point with the extra space storage. I mean, he does not feel that there's going to be any conflict.
Without lot 3 and 1, I see that there's some semi-parking shown on outlot 3.
There is. Closed. There is.
So
He's not concerned at this point.
In fact, I met with him on two occasions, him and the assistant chief, and we talked about it. He does not have any concerns.
Good.
Only that the road is still maintained for their use, and that we work through the construction around their emergencies.
Any other questions? What's your pleasure?
Move to send a favorable recommendation to the village board pursuant to all of the comments and questions that have been raised tonight.
I'll second.
Motion made and seconded for approval of the master conceptual plan. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the ayes have it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item C and D will be taken together, but separate action on each one. Item C is a public hearing and consideration of a plan commission resolution 1905 for amendment to the village comprehensive plan. And item D is public hearing and consideration of a conceptual plan. Gene?
As you indicated, Trustee Serpy, items C and D will be discussed at the same time. However, separate actions are going to be required. The two items are Resolution 1905 for an amendment to the village's comprehensive plan related to an amendment to the Whittier Creek Neighborhood Plan, which is north of 93rd Street and east of Old Green Bay Road. And the second is consideration of a conceptual plan. And these are at the request of Dan Schopp of Bear Development, LLC, agent for Creekside PP, LLC, and they're the owners of the vacant properties north of Creekside Crossing, and this area is to be known as the Vista at Creekside. The developer is proposing 43 single-family lots, one two-family lot, and seven 20-unit apartment buildings and a clubhouse. Specifically, the petitioner then is proposing this development. It is to be known as the Vista at Creekside, which includes tax parcel numbers 924-122-153-0070, 924-122-153-0080, 924-122-153-0090, 924-122-153-0092, 924-122-153-0727, 924-122-153-0728, and parcel 924-122-153-0729. The items are being considered for approval, which include an amendment to the comprehensive plan, which is the Whittier Creek Neighborhood Plan, and a conceptual plan for the development. As some background information, the Creekside Crossing condominium, including 8-unit, 4-unit, and 2-unit buildings, and single-family residential development, were initially developed in several phases by Mastercraft Builders from 2005 through 2010. Portions of the development were then sold under to other contractors, and units were constructed from 2010 to 2014. The original development anticipated 24 single-family lots, 36 two-unit condominium buildings, 16 four-unit condominium buildings, and 19 eight-unit condominium buildings. All of the single-family lots have since been developed, and all of the condominium units, with the exception of 2 8-unit buildings, have been built within the existing platted condominium area. The undeveloped land proposed to be developed for the condominium purposes would have included a total of 158 additional condominium units. Or in this case, they would have built an additional 11 8-unit buildings, 5 4-unit buildings, and 25 2-unit buildings. Due to the recession, this area had remained vacant for several years until it's purchased by Creekside PP LLC, who intended to develop the vacant properties. On August 17, 2015, the Village Board conditionally approved a concept plan to develop the remaining vacant land north and west of the Creekside subdivision and the Creekside Crossing subdivision, and the condominium development adjacent to 89th, 90th, 91st Streets, 90th Place, 62nd Avenue, and Creekside Circle. At that time, they were proposing 64 single-family lots and 1 2-family lot. The developers, after reevaluation, could not move forward with this single-family, two-family proposal due to the extreme high cost of constructing Creekside Circle and the bridge and all the public improvements. Thus, the plan never moved forward. At this time, a new development plan is being proposed for the remaining Creekside vacant properties, which is about 58 acres, and additional vacant properties, 4 acres on the south side of 91st Street, east of Old Green Bay Road. The proposed development includes 43 single-family lots, 1 2-family lot, and 7 20-unit apartment buildings, and a clubhouse, with about 31 acres of the 62-acre development site because of a large amount of green space and floodplain and wetland to the north and the central portion of the development. There will be a large area that still remains as conservancy. Under the comprehensive plan amendment, the petitioner is requesting an amendment of a portion of the Whittier Creek Neighborhood Plan in Appendix 9.3 as a result of the development of the remainder of the Creekside Crossing development. The project now is being referred to as the Vista at Creekside. The entire Whittier Creek neighborhood is bounded by Highway 31 or Green Bay Road on the west, 85th Street on the north, Hooper Road on the east, and 93rd Street on the south. This amendment is only for a portion of the southwest corner of that neighborhood. As a reminder, neighborhood plans, which are a component of the village's comprehensive plan, are intended to provide the community with a means of reviewing the patterns of existing and probable future development in and around an area proposed for land development, evaluating access to the land development and the feasibility of developing certain uses, lot layouts, roadways and parkways, open green space areas and preservation areas, schools, municipal facilities, and municipal services to serve a neighborhood area. And again, oftentimes neighborhoods are about a 1 mile to 1.5 mile square area. It's not coming down to just that particular subdivision, but it does encompass a much larger area, typically bounded by public streets. The neighborhood plan sets forth a guide for future development when a willing landowner wishes to develop his land or her land. In accordance with the Village Comprehensive Plan, the Whittier Creek neighborhood is classified as a low medium density residential land use category, having lot areas that range from 12,000 to 19,000 square feet or more per dwelling unit. This range allows for some areas of the neighborhood to have larger lots, while other areas would have smaller lots, and it's designed to accommodate a variety of housing types. As land continues to be developed, the village evaluates proposals and amendments to neighborhood plans based on other elements of the comprehensive plan as well. For primarily residential neighborhoods like the Whittier Creek neighborhood, the housing element of the village's comprehensive plan is used for guidance. And again, this comprehensive plan was adopted by the community in December of 2009 pursuant to the state's smart growth plan and initiatives at that time. The village's housing goal is to provide a diverse housing supply that meets the village's future population needs. This includes homes for new residents without prejudice, as well as for long-time residents whose housing requirements might have changed because of age, household growth, or decline, income, or disability. To meet this comprehensive planning goal, several objectives are set forth in our comprehensive plan. I'll just go through a couple of them for you. Promote the provision of an adequate number of housing units and allocate sufficient land area for housing demands to accommodate current and future population. To encourage a full range of housing structure types and sizes, including single-family, two-family, and multifamily, in sewer service areas to provide for housing options for households of all income levels, ages, and special needs projected for the village in 2035. To allocate sufficient land for residential development to accommodate future populations. To encourage new residential areas to be located in neighborhoods served by public sanitary sewer and water and contain reasonable areas for walking or biking necessary for supporting things like parks, schools, and shopping. Residents should have reasonable access to employment centers, community and major shopping centers, government centers, and secondary schools and higher education. To encourage the flexible zoning techniques to accommodate a variety of housing options, such techniques may include live-work units, planned unit developments, known as PUDs, planned development districts, known as PDDs, cluster development, and conservation developments. To the extent practicable, residential and employment-generating land uses should be located so as to provide opportunities for living closer to work. Promote a range of affordable housing choices for village residents. Encourage the development of life cycle housing for the village residents. Promote a safe and attractive built environment within the village. Residential development should be located and designed to minimize impacts to the natural resource base and to prevent the encroachment of incompatible land uses and minimizing adverse impacts on the environment. The comprehensive plan sets forth recommendations to achieve our housing goals and objectives. Some of our recommendations include to develop land use plan maps to accommodate projected growth in population, households, and employment through the design year of 2035, to provide sufficient housing options so that all income levels in the village can afford housing using a maximum of 30% of their gross household income, to continue to support a variety of housing types and sizes, and to designate areas for single, two-family, and multifamily housing and through detailed neighborhood plans. The village zoning ordinance should continue to allow for a full range of housing types and sizes to ensure the provision of the units that are affordable for the households and income levels in the village, and to continue to administer and enforce the zoning ordinance, land division, and other ordinances of the village to implement our plan. The proposed amendments to the neighborhood plan provided in the attached Plan Commission resolution continue to support the village's goals and objectives and recommendations to provide for a variety of housing types for all residents that choose to live and work in our village. Under residential development in the village, the amendments add about 5 acres to the residential land area in the neighborhood. Therefore, approximately 350 acres of land within this particular neighborhood are proposed to be developed for residential uses. In looking at the screen, you can see that those areas that are designated in the yellow and the light brown and the dark brown, those are the areas that are identified for residential purposes. Everything else in the neighborhood that is identified in light green is a conservancy area for the most part, whether it's wetland or floodplain or some type of conservancy area. And the dark green areas are either woodland conservancy areas, or in this case in the south corner that's shown on this particular plan, it's the Ingram Community Park that's being developed by the village. Within the entire neighborhood, based on this amendment, there's approximately 392 existing dwelling units. 258 are single-family lots, and 134 are existing platted multifamily condominium units in the neighborhood as part of the Creekside Crossing condominiums. There are also six existing multifamily condominium units on Old Green Bay Road, south of the Jerome Creek, and eight two-unit buildings located on Old Green Bay Road, north of the Jerome Creek. There are 396 proposed dwelling units. 254 would be single-family lots, one proposed duplex, which is a two-unit, and 140 proposed multifamily rental units. This would be seven 20-unit apartment buildings, and this would provide for affordable workforce housing for those employed within the village. In accordance with the village's comprehensive plan, the overall net density for the neighborhood is recommended to be within that lower medium density residential land use category, with the average lot area again between 12,000 and 18,999 square feet per dwelling unit. The variety of housing types and the sizing within this neighborhood provides a net density of 19,348 square feet per dwelling unit. So the net density, even with this amendment, falls outside the higher range of the density. So the overall density is lower than what is required by our comprehensive plan. Population projections for the neighborhood. The vacant portions of the neighborhood will not develop until property owners wish to develop their land, which makes neighborhood planning essential for the orderly growth of our community, and it establishes a framework as to how development should occur if and when it does occur. The neighborhood plan is a guide for the property owners and the developers. Therefore, the population will increase on a very incremental basis as the neighborhood develops over time. Population calculations are based on numbers from the 2010 census information for the village. In the village, the average number of persons per household is 2.71, and school-aged children between the ages of 5 and 19 make up about 22.6% of the population. The village provides copies of these developments to KUSD to assist in their long-range planning, and this is with every residential development in the village. Pursuant to the information provided by KUSD to the village, 42% of the new dwelling units will have new students that will attend public schools. Again, we've got quite a few single-family homes that are being proposed as part of this development, and that is where the large part of the new population for students will be coming from. Current population within the neighborhood is based on 392 dwelling units and approximately 240 school-aged children, with 164 attending public school could expect to come from the development with respect to the current population. Projected population at 788 dwelling units, there's potential 483 school-aged children with 331 children attending public school. Again, we've been doing this now for about 30 years, and it has really come to prove to be true with respect to the percentage of children. And again, because the growth has been incremental, it's not like a big hit at one time with respect to the growth of students within the district. The Vista at Creekside conceptual plan. The petitioner is requesting approval of a conceptual plan for the Vista at Creekside development, which would include 43 single-family lots, which is primarily in the center, north-central part of the development, one two-family lot, which is in the very north-east corner, which Peggy is going to be identifying with red or yellow, with red. And then there'll be 7 20-unit apartment buildings, 5 of which are located in the Creekside development that we had been talking about that pre-existed, and then 2 of them will be outside adjacent to 91st Street closer to Old Green Bay Road. In addition, there will be a clubhouse that you would pass as you enter off of Old Green Bay Road on 91st Street into the development. In addition, 31 acres of the 61 acres of the development site will remain as open space. For the single-family lots, the 43 single-family lots range in size from 12,721 square feet to 25,694 square feet per lot. The average lot size is greater than a third of an acre. It's at 16,475 square feet. All lots will be a minimum of 12,500. They'll have a minimum of 80 feet of road frontage, which could be reduced on a cul-de-sac or curve. All lots will have the minimum depth of 125 feet. A majority of the lots for single family abut up to open space, retention basins, wetlands, or floodplains. It's proposed that the homes will range from about $400,000 to $525,000 and would be comparable to the Arbor Ridge subdivision that's currently under construction by the petitioner in Prairie Ridge. That new development is just south of the Frater South Main Hospital, which is adjacent to apartment buildings and senior apartment buildings. The two-family lot, the petitioner is proposing to create one additional two-family lot, and that would be, as Peggy noted and is shown in the in white, one two-family lot that will be right at the end of where the other existing two-family condominiums are located. This duplex will include 2 ranch-style units that are similar to the existing adjacent 2-unit buildings. With respect to the multifamily buildings, again, this conceptual plan provides for 2 different apartment building areas with a clubhouse for a total of 140 units. Each of the apartment buildings provides for 8 units on the first floor and 12 units on the second floor. And they will range in size from 713 square feet, which is one bedroom, to 1,325 square feet, with 8 units in each building having an attached garage. All units are considered condominium style, and that they all will have units will have individual entries, no common hallways. They'll have their entries from the exterior of the building, no shared entrances. Revised elevations have been submitted and are attached in your packets, and Peggy is showing them up on the front, that show a variety of building materials, but primarily stone, brick, and hardy board, with a variety of gray and blue tone colors. When the developer makes his presentation, he will have the materials and other documents to show you. Each building provides a variety of options, including 1 bedroom with 1 bath. There will be 11 of those. 1 2-bedroom with 1 bath, 6 2-bedroom, 2 bath, and 2 3-bedroom with 2 bath options. So again, there's a lot of different options and varieties of unit sizes within the buildings. The entire multifamily development will include 77 1-bedroom units, 49 2-bedroom units, and 14 3-bedroom units. The rents, again, go from the 1 bedrooms, will range from $700 to $970. The 2 bedrooms between $840 to $1,175. And the 3 bedrooms between $970 and $1,425. Pursuant to the applicant, these rental rates are in line with market rate rents. The petitioner has submitted and has successfully received an award of housing tax credits to fund a portion of the development for workforce housing. There are many types of tax credits used to construct a variety of housing types. The housing tax credits awarded to this project are not for low-income housing. These are for workforce housing, and there is a difference. Low-income housing typically serves area median incomes at or below 30% of the area median income. The housing development being proposed is not low-income. It is income-restricted as workforce housing that provides for rental rates that are very similar to the current market rate rents. Workforce housing is designed for active individuals and families with working parents or single working professionals. These units are dedicated to those not typically understood to be targets of affordable housing. The workforce housing requirements mandate a maximum rental rate as well as the maximum income of the residents so that they can pay the rent. All tenants must have a minimum 3 times their total monthly rent in income to qualify for any unit within any of the proposed development areas. Therefore, if you're in a 701-bedroom unit, the tenant must have a monthly income of at least $2,100. But that does not include their utilities. They still have to be able to afford gas and electric utilities and cable that are not included in the rent. The goal of these units is to offer efficient and sustainable housing solutions that enable individuals in moderate income vocations and emerging young professionals such as police officers, firefighters, teachers, health professionals, service workers, to live in the community that they work in. As a result of the neighborhood meeting the developer had with the property owners in November with the existing residents within the Creekside development, they acquired additional land to the west and moved a total of 40 apartments to the west. And they added the clubhouse at that area as well in order to provide a main entrance for the development. The new main entrance to the development will be from Old Green Bay Road and 91st Street. At this entrance, there's a clubhouse with 28 parking spaces. The clubhouse will have a leasing and management office, community gathering space, and an exercise room. Adjacent to the clubhouse and the south side of 91st Street, it will be 20-unit buildings with 8 attached garages in each building, and also a detached garage with an additional 28 garage spaces and a total of 8 surface parking spaces. Further east, on the north side of Creekside Circle, there will be 5 20-unit buildings with 8 attached garages in each building and 3 detached garage buildings with 24 garage spaces. And then there will be some additional surface parking. The parking space calculations by ordinance don't necessarily count a parking space behind each of the attached garages, so there is additional parking behind each of the attached garages as well. And in reality, that allows for additional parking. The village will be required that there will be a minimum of 1 enclosed space per unit to be provided, and that is what they've shown. Population projections. Again, based on the 2010 census information for the village, the average number of persons per household was 2.71, and school-age children make up between the ages of 5 and 19 make up 22.6% of the population. So within this development, with their proposal, with 43 single-family lots and the 1 two-unit and then the 140 units, there'll be a total of 185 dwelling units. It's projected that 502 persons will be added to the population upon full build-out of the development, and 77 school-age children are likely to come from this development at full build-out. With respect to the floodplain boundary adjustment, again, this takes us back. On October 20, 2003, originally the Village Board adopted a resolution, 0342, to approve the floodplain boundary adjustment for the Creekside development. In 2005, January, the developer of Creekside Crossing obtained all the required permits from FEMA to begin the floodplain adjustment work. The floodplain boundary adjustment work had begun in this area, that's already developed, but it had not been completed for the entire project for the area to the north. FEMA approval is still valid and will be completed by the petitioner as originally designed and approved by the village, DNR, and FEMA. With respect to wetlands, the wetlands shown within the outlots will remain undisturbed and protected during construction. 2 small wetland areas totaling 9,321 square feet are proposed to be filled within Creekside Circle and 91st Street to finish those public improvements. Fill permits will be required to be obtained from DNR and the Corps prior to the approval of the final plat. A portion of Wetland 5 is also located in a future right-of-way that will be dedicated but not constructed, and that's at the very northeast corner of the development site. In the future, if adjacent property owners want to develop that area to the north or east, those developers will be required to obtain fill permits from the DNR and the Corps to extend the public improvements. So site access, the primary access for the Vista development will be from Old Green Bay Road at 91st Street. However, Creekside Circle will be completed, the bridge will be completed, the roadway pavement and the infrastructure, and that will connect to 93rd Street at 63rd and 65th Avenue, 66th Avenues as originally proposed. 91st Street via Old Green Bay Road will be its primary building construction access, and Hall Road access for the primary development of the subdivision infrastructure and the residential development. Temporary no construction access signs will be required at the entrance of 93rd Street during the development of the construction of the primary public improvements as well as the construction. However, in the next few months, the developer is requesting approval to allow approximately 9,500 cubic yards of clay fill material from a nearby residential site to be hauled into the development site and placed in the northeast portion of the site to provide for additional fill material needed for that development because of the analysis and the balancing of the site. If this is approved, the Village Public Works Department would closely monitor the activities, and any damage to roadways would be the responsibility of Bear Development. The developer has explored several ways to get the material that will be available shortly using future 91st Street from Old Green Bay Road, but the path from Old Green Bay Road to the site's low area would require a permit from the DNR and would require the immediate installation of stone. The developer would request that this come from the south as opposed from 91st, but that will be for further discussion by the Plan Commission and the Board. With respect to public improvements, all public and private improvements shall be made by the developer at the developer's expense. The entire development shall be provided with and serviced by municipal roadways, public roadways, sanitary sewer, water, and storm sewer. Specifically, municipal roadways, public roadways shall be extended throughout the development pursuant to the new development standard, which means that these will be concrete roads. Sidewalks and pedestrian ways. Public sidewalks shall be extended on Creekside Circle, 90th Street, 62nd Avenue, and 91st Street, and private pedestrian paths connecting public walkways on 62nd Avenue and Creekside Circle will be provided as shown on the attached drawings. That's shown on the slide at this time. The sidewalks and pedestrian pathways will be installed by the developer at the developer's cost and will not be assessed to any of the existing property owners or condominium association. However, once the sidewalks are installed, sidewalk maintenance and snow removal on the sidewalks would be the responsibility of the abutting landowners. Municipal water and sanitary sewer. Municipal water will need to be extended throughout the development and shall connect to the existing municipal water in Creekside Crossing and extended in 91st Street to Old Green Bay Road. Sanitary sewer will need to be extended from the existing sewer mains in Creekside Crossing development to service the entire remaining balance of the development site. Zoning map and text amendments will be required. The development site will need to be rezoned as follows. The single family would need to be rezoned into the R4, Urban Single Family Residential District. The two family lots will need to be rezoned into the R8 two family district. And the lots with the apartment buildings and clubhouse would need to be rezoned into the R11 multiple family district. Wetland areas would be placed into the C1 lowland conservancy district. Outlots would be placed into the PR1 neighborhood park and recreational district. And any floodplains would be placed into the FPO district. The entire development would be in a planned unit development overlay. The PUD would allow for some dimensional flexibility, provided that there's defined community benefit. Some of the PUD variations would include to allow for more than one multifamily building per parcel, to provide for minimum lot sizes of 12,500 square feet and 80 feet of frontage for the single family lots, as long as they all average at least 15,000 square feet, to provide for minimum lot sizes of lot size of 17,500 for the two family lot. Part of the community benefit is the requirement that all of the apartment buildings would be provided with residential sprinkler systems, that sidewalk interconnections would be placed in the right-of-way extending to the existing park on the south side of the Creekside development. They would be adding some additional park equipment in the public park. They are providing enhanced architectural details for the building and additional landscaping, as well as additional plantings in the development areas. And in addition, the multifamily areas will be required to be equipped with the DSIS system. So that is that digital security imaging system that, as you know, we require in many other areas of the village. And the DSIS agreement will require that those cameras are live fed back to the PD. So with that, that's the staff's presentation at this point for the Creekside conceptual plan and the comprehensive plan for the neighborhood plan amendment. The developer is here. I would like to present some additional details, building materials, and I'm sure they'd be happy to answer some additional questions as well as the staff.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you. S.R. Mills, 41180 Street, Kenosha, Wisconsin. excuse me. Appreciate the time and the detail that staff has gone into the proposal here and all of the specifics. I certainly won't look to reiterate all of those, but I will try and piece out a few of the highlights, a few of the concerns that we've heard to date, and provide some commentary and some thoughts as to how we're attempting to address them and ensure that it's a win-win economically for the community and for the neighborhood. As mentioned, the 58-acre site, previously Mastercraft, had a condominium development there, approximately 172 units. It's 58 acres in total. We acquired it about 6 years ago from a lender. It had went back. It's a very tough site to develop. Part of the reason for that is it was mid-construction, so we had we weren't entirely sure what went into the ground, what didn't go into the ground as far as pipe, grading, so it required quite a bit of detail and study to continue to make sense of it to ensure that it could be rectified, and we didn't have a lot of pipe in the ground that was going to go to waste either. Anytime that we look at a development, we always break it down to a few basic principles. One, it has to be economically viable. We don't want a similar situation that something's left mid-construction, that it's an issue and problems for everybody later on. It was also very important for us to try and figure out a way to complete Creekside Circle and 91st Street going out to Old Green Bay Road. Life safety issues, just the neighborhood, felt that would make the most sense for everybody, and also the completing the neighborhood from the standpoint of just the aesthetic, to have something that undone going on for decades. Wanted to have it completed and, again, have it an appropriate scale and design for the area. 43 single-family lots, one two-family, and 140 multifamily units comprised of seven 20-unit buildings. As mentioned, the multifamily is direct access, meaning that it's condominium style. Everybody has a front door. You don't go into a common corridor hallway with an elevator. We found that this is desirable. The overall, our vacancy rates are less than 2% with the product that we've constructed and operate, so we've seen the market respond to that. We think it's something that will stand the test of time from the standpoint that it's somebody's home. It feels more like a traditional home condominium, that you have your front door, you have your own porch area, and you have that sense of space that this affords you. Also with the, let's talk about the materials, cement board siding, stone, brick, high quality building. We think it would look great. You know, as we continue to build and to develop, we try and make it better every time, and we certainly learn something at each development and each building we build. So we like to think this is the culmination of a handful of experiences we've had, and think it would be a product that will not only look great in the neighborhood and blend different styles, but you know, from a color standpoint and the palette, we think it'll also have a great neighborhood feel with the sidewalks, and I think it'd again be a real positive overall. Total development cost on the multifamily alone would be about $29 million. Excuse me. Large development. From a parking standpoint, that's something that we're very hyper concerned over. We can't create parking problems for our tenants or our communities. So I think we're overparked here. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. One, in trying to balance the density issues with the amount of the space that we have, try and find that balance. We're almost 2.4 parking stalls per unit. That does include an area behind the garage, but we feel that most communities that we look at, we try and use the two ratio. So we won't always have two parking stalls per unit. So this exceeds that. So we feel good about that we won't have pinch points and have problems when it comes to parking. The 43 single-family lots, Arbor Ridge is a great comp because it's something that we recently worked on, converted a multifamily to 45 single-family units, a multifamily site to 45 single-family units. Currently, we have about half of them sold. I believe we have 12 contracts out there right now. From a construction standpoint, average 450 to 475. I envision that this site will be, it will continue to see escalations in the costs and the prices here with the assessed valuations and what the end product will be. So I think the assumption between 400 and 550 is pretty spot on. And the two family up in the northeast corner up there, it's really to stay in line with the balance of the two families. So we didn't feel it was appropriate to put a single family home back on that site, but keeping with that same two family. So from an aesthetic standpoint, it'll be very similar to what we have on the east and the west side of that street. Always appreciate the dialogue with elected officials, staff, neighborhood. We had a neighborhood meeting, and we learned a lot. We always think that these projects are better after going through that. And while sometimes it's there's a lot of back and forth, but it really does make it better. We're never so presumptuous to think that we have all the best ideas and the way we want to do it is the best way. We learned a lot during that meeting. It was a few months ago at the RecPlex. Based on some of that information, we did make some pretty significant changes. We switched around placement of the multifamily with the single family, the community room, the clubhouse, which, as Gene mentioned, is the fitness area, the community room, full-time management office, kitchen area will be located off of Old Green Bay Road. We think it'll be a positive. And it also pushes some of the density further to Green Bay Road, as we heard some of the traffic concerns and issues that not wanting traffic to go back through to the southeast, which I can appreciate, trying to push that further to the northwest, seems to make some sense, and I think it continues to hopefully alleviate many of the concerns here. Some of the other concerns we heard was the density. I think it is important to remember what was there, too. This is a fully platted multifamily development for 172 units. We acquired an additional 4 acres to the west. So if you look just by the circumference of the map with what we have, we're actually proposing less density with single family on this 58 acres. Again, it's maybe not what everybody wants, but it is something that we think is economically viable and it's doable, and we can get it done, and it'll be great once it's all completed. Some of the other feedback that we've heard is the rental rates and the workforce housing. So I want to address that head on and what that really means and what it doesn't mean, because there can be a lot of fear and a lot of unknown with that. So we try and be as direct as we can at what it really is. So we received workforce housing credits. What those credits do is they allow us to build a $29 million development that we never could before, because you couldn't afford to do it. With the rental rates the way that they are, we could never build something that looks this great, that has the kind of site work, cost, and infrastructure without getting those credits. What those credits do is they mandate that we keep rents at a reasonable level. We cannot increase them 5% per year, 10% per year. We have to keep them within these tolerances. Now, those tolerances today are $700 to $970 for a one-bedroom, $840 to $1,175 for a two, and $970 to $1,425 for a three.
those, as Gene mentioned, that's not low income here. Everybody has to have a lawful source of income. That we have to, you know, we, our tenants, they have to pay the rent. They have to make sure they're there. We will only have great citizens. We have significant background checks, and everybody has to be great, or we will, you know, we're quick to evict, and we have bad situations because we have to. We've got a very, very big vested interest here. But this is this. Who will live here are people who make between $22,000 to $25,000 a year and $70,000 a year, and it's people at all different spots in their life, from people that are out of high school and college and first and second jobs in their 20s to young families starting off to retirees. And we've seen this in a lot of the developments that we do. It's a broad spectrum, and in reality, the rental rates here are not that different from the market rate. There's maybe some small fluctuations, but it's pretty spot on with what we see. So this is not – the workforce piece of this should not be scary. It is comparable to market rate developments that are done in Pleasant Prairie and in throughout southeastern Wisconsin. And it's something that, you know, we're locals. We're not going anywhere. It's something that we stand by, and we're going to ensure it's a great product. Part of that, too, is we have 43 single-family lots that we need to sell for about an average of $110,000 a lot, $450,000 to $525,000, which is that total value of that single family product at the end of the day, right across the street. So we very much have a vested interest to ensure it's great. We wouldn't do anything. We would not cut off our nose here to spite our face with this product. And we're very confident that it will be high quality, and it'll be something that we can all be proud of at the end of the day. Again, some of the feedback that we heard at the meeting and throughout the process here is that it's going to be impossible to sell single-family lots across from the multifamily. Again, we just don't believe that to be true. A great example is Arbor Ridge, where we actually have a four-story development, fine developments of rental product. We weren't involved in it, but we made the commitment after that product was up to create 45 single-family lots just to the southwest of it. And happy to report that the sales are doing well and the neighborhood's looking more and more complete every day. So, again, I'm here to answer any questions you might have, and appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Gene, do you have anything else? Okay, before I open up to public comments, I think what we'll do is ask staff to kind of jot down the concerns and questions that the public may have, and at the end we'll address those rather than address each one as each person comes up. So with that, again, we'll need your name and address, and please speak into the microphone so everybody can hear your comments. This is a public hearing. Anybody wishing to speak? Anybody wishing to speak? Yes, ma'am. Yep, please.
Good evening. I'm Karen Denhartug at 9203 62nd Court in Creekside Crossing Subdivision. First, I'd like to say thank you for the time to give us a chance to be heard. I also want to thank the developers. We do recognize some really positive changes you've made in your plans. I particularly like the movement of the clubhouse to the west of the property. I think that's very positive. The sidewalks is a nice touch, but I am not clear on what our ultimate responsibility will be as far as those new sidewalks right across from the single-family homes. I live in the first cul-de-sac just to the south of the property, right across from the park that is currently existing as a tot lot. One of my concerns that I want to bring up is the original plan for development of the community was another park in the northern section of the property, and that's no longer there. But we have the addition of more than double of the homes and people that are going to be living in this community without the additional park space for the kids and the community members. So I'm wondering if there's any plan to reintroduce a park in this particular community. I also want to oppose the use of the main entrance to our community for any movement of the fill clay that is intended to start the build. Because I live in that first cul-de-sac on the corner, every headlight that comes in our community hits my front window. And I read earlier on the planning that it can be up to about 30 truckloads a day, which is, I think, quite excessive for an existing community. We also have a lot of children in our community, and I'm really concerned about that extra traffic affecting their ability to cross the street to go to the park. Currently, the Creekside Crossing street that we live on, there are some concerns with the traffic. We've had quite a number of cars over the years that speed down that side right past our houses. It's a long straight shot. I'm concerned with the additional, you know, residential housing that's going in there that's going to increase the traffic flow, and I'm very concerned about that. I did see on the planning also that there's a road intended in the future to the northeast part of the property that's going to meet up with Cooper Road eventually, and I would like to know when that's going to happen. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I'm Bill Demo, 9285 66th Avenue. I'm also president of the Creekside Crossing Condo Association. So clearly we're concerned about long-term value of our property. Most of us have been homeowners before the big dip in 2008, and we finally realized a positive increase in the value of our property. And I understand that they're, from a density point of view, they don't seem to be increasing it, or they have less density with the population with this new design and the original plans for the Creekside Crossing. But, you know, presently we have... So I need to look at you? Okay.
Bill, get as close to the microphone as you can. There you go. Okay. That'll work, too.
That'll work.
I typically don't have a hard time being heard, but... let's see, where it's... Oh, density. I know that they've made adjustments to the way that they let out these buildings, but originally... You know, we have 19 buildings that are on the north side or south side of the circle, and that 19 buildings would have been mirrored with the further construction had Creekside Crossing plan been executed. So they've really taken these and they've packed them into the corner. The other thing that they've done is they've moved a lot of the buildings into that far northeast corner, which now really is concentrated to the 10 buildings that we have in the backside. We have the maintenance responsibility for that pond in the northeast corner and the two other ponds in the development, so I'm concerned about any additional burden financially that might be incurred now that we have those buildings there. We presently don't have sidewalks in the neighborhood. You know, we're opposed to the sidewalks. All that additional sidewalks was turned over to the owners would now be an additional financial impact on the 114 homeowners that we have inside the association. That's a shared responsibility now to take care of snow removal. I had a question on the DSI. What is that specifically? The digital? Oh.
So about 12 years ago, the village decided to come up with an activity or procedure of installing digital security imaging systems, camera systems, if you will, cameras on light posts, buildings, so on and so forth. So many, many of the commercial buildings, as well as the multifamily buildings, anything built since about 2007, is required to have live cameras placed on areas throughout the site with images live back through web connections back to the PD.
Okay.
And so at any point in time, if there's an incident, an accident, if there's information needed because of an investigation, the individual company or the, in this case, Bear Development, will need to archive video for up to 30 days through a secured DVR system. so that the PD can get access to that in order to do further investigations. You probably don't realize it, but there's literally thousands of cameras throughout the village that are helping our PD as well as our fire department before they get to an incident or accident or to investigate.
That's good to know.
And not many people know that, but it has been invaluable for our department.
Well, it's come up in every conversation on every project up at this point, so I just want to make sure I understood that. Leasing, well, I've got questions for Bear on who is going to be, are they the leasing agent going forward?
Well, they'll answer those after.
All right. Another question I have is, we're saying $700 is now the low end of the rent. Can that be or lowered if there's any particular case that anybody that shows a need so that now we're down to a lower income threshold? And at the 30% level, that $700 is an annual income of about $25,000, which is, I would believe, pretty low for the village and where we're at. We're also concerned that there's not this type of development in the whole south end of the village. I mean, I don't know of any other examples of this that exists south of 85th Street coming down to the south or east to the lake. So it would seem that we're forcing this in, this unusual concept for the surrounding neighborhoods into this area. And that, it just, I understand the financial end for Bear and what they're trying to do. I just don't see where it meshes with the rest of the things that have been built and done in that end of the village. And then so I'm assuming that the additional buildings don't result in any additional cost to the taxpayers for fire protection, police protection. That's all accounted for and doesn't put an additional burden on those resources. That would be a question for later. And I think that's all I have.
Thanks, Bill. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Tish Tippett, and I live on 62nd Avenue, 8966. I am one of the two-unit condos. They're ranch-styled. It's a 2,900-square-foot ranch in reality. It's just split with one wall, so there's two units. We have a large lot. Oh, sorry. We have a really large lot, but when I purchased here, when you pull into the main entrance, you got a T. You have to go left or right. If you look on there, you'll see that to the west are two-story, four-unit, eight-unit condo buildings. And if you go to the right on the circle, those are all homes. We're a two-unit condo, but yet in reality, we're really a large house. So the subdivision is split. You have the two units, two-story, and then you have homes. When I bought, the developer, Mastercraft, assured me that along that pond, because my backyard is with that pond, there were going to be additional units just like what I have there. And then the remaining land would be homeowners, single family. So I was really shocked when we went to the meeting at RecPlex to find out what they proposed. Originally, his proposal was to have 80 apartments right behind us. And now, at that meeting, I suggested, first off, we're all homeowners. Why are we bringing rentals into our subdivision? So then when they went on and talked some more, and I said, okay, instead of putting these 80 apartments by us, why aren't they all going on the west section where you have the two-story multiple condos? And that road they're putting into 91st, why didn't they put them all over there? Why don't they have houses down where they want to put the 80, which now turns into 100? We now have 100 apartments they want to put behind us. How many garage buildings with how many parking spots? And I really wonder if Bear intends to, when they sell these lots off, are they going to sell it without letting the people knowing these apartments they plan on putting into the subdivision? Lastly, I guess my frustration is between my neighbor Bob, who lives on the unit with me, between him and I, we have a large lot, a large home in reality, and we pay over $8,000 in property taxes. I think that Bear, when they said they wanted to put the houses more toward where their houses were, they were trying to show respect to those homeowners. I think we deserve just as much respect as those homeowners because in reality we are one large house. So my request is that they build them all into the west section if we have to have these apartments, which I still think is just ridiculous. I don't think that the village would do this to, I know this is an exaggeration, but Meadowdale Estates, I don't think you'd ever put something like this in their subdivision, let alone I don't think those people would let you, they'd sue you. So I am totally opposed to this proposal.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak? Yes, sir.
Yes, my name's Bob Hannes. I live at 8980 62nd Avenue. When I get up in the morning, I can look out my window. It's beautiful. I got the pond behind me. Now I get up, I'm going to have to look at 5 20-unit apartment buildings. I don't think that's a good idea. And if they can't make money without them 20-unit apartment buildings, they shouldn't have bought that land to develop. I didn't buy that place I live in now to look at 20-unit apartment buildings. Another thing I don't understand is, why do you want to put sidewalks in by us? Nobody's going to use them. All you're going to do is drive up our association, feed a shovel. But that's a bad plan. We asked them at the meeting if they could take them apartment buildings in 20 units and move them west to Green Bay Road. And at the time, there was only 4 of them. So now they come back and they added another one and they didn't move them. I mean, you people think it's a good idea, but I don't. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll get you next. Okay.
Go ahead, sir. My name is Ken Haryu. I live at 9249 64th Court, Unit 162. Thanks for talking to me today, and I'm going to take some time. We're going to go over a little history about their development in a minute. I've been there about 3 years now. When I was going to purchase my condo, I came to your window in the south end of this building. I said, what's going to happen to me? They said, don't worry, Ken. You're going to have comparable housing there. Thanks a lot. And I made an offer on my house. I had about 10 hours to do that because it was a hot property at the time. I don't think it's going to be too hot any longer. Like Bill said, many of my neighbors, especially the older folk that live on the first floors, have barely made up back above water in the last year. And this is what they get to hear about when they finally break even, subsidized housing. We can call it whatever you want to call it. It's subsidized housing. I'll get to that in a little while, though. Let's go to a little history lesson, their development. There's 7 property numbers in this development they purchased. The first two are on that west side where their one garage is, just to right of that. One of them was 0.31 acres. One of them was 2.5 acres. Total of 2.8 acres they bought for $50,000. That's shrewd. I admire shrewd. I wish I was shrewd with all my stocks. Shrewd is a good thing. That's from a transfer deed number 182-7977 on the Kenosha County site. Just so you know where I'm getting my information. The other 5 PIN numbers, which are all listed here, total of 59.14 acres, they bought for $500,000. Another shrewd investment. At that time, they knew what was zoned there. It was zoned R8 and R10 and R4. Right now, where they have all the 5 units, apartment buildings is R8. That's supposed to be all two-unit buildings just like the other side of the pond. That's what you're supposed to be looking at. The middle circle is all zoned R10 and R8, which would be 8 units and 4 units, which is on the south end. Where the yellow buildings are on Old Grand Green Bay Road is R4, single family. So Bear knows all this when they buy it. I take a risk when I buy my condo not knowing what's there. Now they come and say, well, we can't be viable. You can't be viable. You only spent $9,000 an acre, folks. $9,000 an acre. And Mr. Mills is crying, poor? Please. So anyway, this is ridiculous. What? Next, how can it be viable? The home lots at Arbor Vista, let's say, average $85,000 a lot. That's pretty close, right? 85. Let's say it takes $30,000 to improve the lot. So at 40 lots, we'll take off three of them for the map, times 30,000, that's 1.2 million. It's going to cost them to put the lots in. $5,000 purchase price, $1.7 million. Wow, big outlay, correct? Average price for the 40 houses, $485,000. Right in their range. We'll take off the $85,000 per lot. So now they get $400,000 per house. The average profit by the general contractor in the house countrywide, 25%. So they make $100,000 per house times 40 is $4 million. $4 million. Plus the $50,000 they're making per lot above their cost. So we're about at $4.5 million profit before we even start looking at the apartments. Then let's read from the November Kenosha newspaper. This is in the legal sections. Sorry about my fumbling around here, a little nervous. I have copies for you when you want them. They went before the Wisconsin Housing Authority and petitioned for, as I'm going to read this, an amount not to exceed $225 million to acquire, construct, and rehabilitate for low and moderate housing. I don't say anything about living wage in this legal notice. For the Creekside Crossing 140-unit multifamily rental housing, they acquired $24,498,000. Now, when I look at this, I see the 1960s. I see the 1970s. I see the 1980s. Dense cluster of subsidized housing. Where has that worked? Nowhere. In fact, everywhere from Milwaukee, Waukegan, Zion, Chicago, they're all trying to figure out what to do. Many communities have knocked them down. So let's all brand new and nice today, but what about 25 years from now when we have subsidized housing in a dense cluster? This is the antiquated approach to our housing issue. Let me read what item two is when Baird Development went to Wisconsin Housing Authority December 6th. 120-unit multifamily rental housing development in and around Milwaukee. And it lists nine different addresses. 100th Road, Mill Road, Milwaukee, Kenosha, 101st Street, Martin Luther King Drive. Sprinkled out a community. That's the new model. It isn't a dense cluster. So the village really needs to look at, how do we want to approach this concept? Now you're sitting there going, how can you vote against affordable housing? It's going to look bad in the paper tomorrow. But why do we want to go backwards? Why do we want to be antiquated? The village is better than this. You professionals are great. They've helped me a lot when I've come to your window. We don't want to go this route. This is going to lead somewhere where we don't need to be. So please, why don't we form a committee, just like we're doing for downtown, and study this problem and figure out which is correct. Like Bill said, where else do we have it? We shouldn't develop policy based on a developer's wish. Now, there's two other developments that have been approved in within 2 miles of here that prove condominiums can be built and be profitable. The cottages of Village Green, a Kent development, putting up beautiful condominiums, 1 and 2 units. They're viable. They're profitable. At your last meeting, you approved the HARP development right at 165 on Old Green Bay Road for 46 condominium units, 2 and 3 units. That's viable. By the way, HARP, on the plan, the original plan, when they bought the land that was supposed to be for 66 units, they even dropped it down to 46, and they're going to make a profit. We welcome that. So I don't know what we can do, but this isn't the way to go. There's one other Bear development in the city that we haven't talked about. It's where Springbrook Road turns into 22nd Ave. And they came before the village board, plan commission last year and say, hey, we need senior housing. We need senior housing. And we need senior housing. But you know what? We got to put a bunch of condos right next to them because else it isn't going to work. Has anybody driven down Springbrook Road and turned a corner? How does that work, guys? How does it look? That's how we're going to shoehorn these things in here, and we're going to be done with it and say the same thing. What did we do here? Why did we do it? We even questioned at the village board meeting last year, does it really need a fourth floor on that building? And of course it did. You know, we have to make money. So I appreciate your time, but this is unacceptable. And we have a master plan, and I heard all about it. I didn't realize there was a 100-page PDF that I needed to study before I came tonight. That just hit the internet a couple days ago. Thanks whoever sent it to me. I didn't have time to study it, else we'd be here all night, folks. But if you vote yes on this, you're voting against all these residents who took the risk to live here. It's a great community. Don't ruin it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak?
Scott Hightower, 9099 62nd Avenue. Just a question of what gets built first, if it's the apartments and then we sit on empty lots like we have in the past, or if we're actually putting up homes and then the apartments get built. Definitely afraid if this gets approved, the apartments will get built first, of course, to get the credits, and we'll sit on a half-finished subdivision just with the apartments that are what's earning it, like Ken said. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak?
I'm Elaine Haru. I live at 9249 64th Court. And I have a letter here that on behalf of Ronald and Elsie Hale, who couldn't be here tonight, so they asked if I could read this letter. This is to the Village of Pleasant Prairie regarding their comprehensive plan amendment and conceptual plan for Whittier Creek and Creekside Crossing. I would like to address the issue above. Having recently received the correspondence dated December 28, 2018, from the Community Development Director regarding the upcoming meetings, I realized I would not be available to attend the meetings. However, I believe my comments should be presented. First, let me state that my wife and I love Pleasant Prairie and the Creekside Crossing community. When we began to look in the area in preparation of my retiring from federal service, we happened upon this gem in southeastern Wisconsin. Our son lives in the Kenosha area. However, we had never been in Pleasant Prairie prior to 2011 when searching areas to build. Creekside Crossing was the community we really desired once we drove through the area. It's well-maintained, tranquil, and family-friendly. The smokestack from the Wee Energy Plant didn't even bother us. After doing some research and contacting the association point of contact, we made the decision to build. The decision was based on the size of the community, the proposed growth as the housing market was rebounding, and the current development plan. One key factor was the nice condominium community at the entrance to the community and the ranch-style condos along 67th Avenue. When I heard of Bayer purchasing the vacant lots, I spoke with one of their representatives. I was told it would be a few years before they started building due to some challenges they had to resolve with the village. But the plan was to continue to build primarily single-family homes as the plan was changed and approved in late 2015 with the change to add one two-family unit at the corner of 67th Avenue and 90th Street. Now to be informed during the meeting at the Recplex that Bayer wants to make further changes is alarming, and to learn that change now is proposed to be primarily multifamily and income restrictions is defeating. I've already discussed relocating due to what I perceive to be the downward spiral of Creekside Crossing if the plan is approved. I, for one, as a current resident, don't appreciate an attempt to change the plan now and apparently for financial gain by Bayer. I question the entire process as they have been awarded 1.03 million tax credits from WIDA for low-income housing. But as I research that process, those credits are awarded after the developer agrees to make a large portion of the units low income. How can Bayer agree to that when they haven't proposed and gained approval from the village unless they are confident it will pass through without delay or challenge? That's alarming and speaks volumes. That aside, personally, I don't want the tranquility of the community disrupted by 140 apartments, the increased traffic and associated risks to children, and the potential for decreased property values due to low income and income-restricted housing. I have many reservations to this proposal, despite the assurances from Bear representatives that this will work. In addition, they stated that other similar projects were working. One such area near St. Catharines is a very different setting. While there may be similarities to what is proposed, the location, openness of the terrain, road layout, proximity to shopping, hospital, and dining make that location better suited. Creekside Crossing is a closed-loop community. I realize the proposed plan is to build an entrance road off of Old Green Bay Road, and as stated during the meeting at Recplex, this new road and its significant expense is one of the reasons for changing the concept. The apartments and the WIDA credits make it more lucrative to Bear. However, the current residents are the ones facing all the risks. Therefore, I am vehemently opposed to any change from the existing plan. I sincerely hope that all village representatives take the input from the residents into consideration. I know that opposition was voiced at the Recplex and within the community since receiving the meeting notice referenced above. Respectfully, Ronald Hale. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
Bill, can you hear me? I'm Ellen Snyder. I live at 9284 66th Avenue, Creekside Condominiums. My husband and I bought a condo and moved in 2015. We had looked at several locations in Illinois, and we always felt they were all too crowded. Too crowded, we kept saying. And then we discovered, kind of by chance, Creekside Condominiums. And the minute we drove in there, they were spread out. When we sit on our porch, we can't see anybody else on their porch because the plan is so excellent, and the way the buildings are located on the property, it's private. And we love it there. We love it there. So when I saw the proposal and I saw the proposed 140 units, I got to tell you, I was pretty sick to my stomach, because to me, that is a lot of people in an area. And I know that you don't live there, but we live here. And we moved there because we loved the openness and we loved the privacy and we love living in a pleasant prairie. And so I don't know what else we can say. I don't know how better to say it than what Bill has said and Ken has said and Elaine and all these people. And I have nothing against you personally, but this is where we live. This is our money that we spent, that we invested in a piece of property in a gorgeous location. So I am begging that you would reconsider. Is there a way to make the numbers less? Do we have to have 140 units that are subsidized? Do we have to have that many units in a small area? I guess that's my challenge to you when you go to vote. Think about us. We live there. This is our hard-earned money. And that's all I can say. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Rita Hagen. My husband Todd and I live at 9228 66th Avenue. We're fairly new to Creekside Crossings, and we did our research as well. We've owned a home for over 34 years in the city of Kenosha, and we downsized and wanted to move into Pleasant Prairie. We love the community. And it would be wrong if I said you don't realize that Pleasant Prairie is a place of growth. You see it. I've seen it all the years I've lived in the city. So you know that your neighborhood is going to change. You just know that. It happens everywhere. But I do have a couple questions because I think everyone agrees that what we object to the most is the apartments. If we made those all condo units like we have now, we'd probably all be happy. Moving them east, moving them west, you're still going to upset somebody. But it's really the apartments we're concerned about. And no matter what you call them, they change a neighborhood. I lived over in what was Gangler's Park Vista. There was the Cranberry Apartments. They added additional apartments. They started out as charging a lot, and then when you can't rent them out, they lower them. So I guess one of my questions would be, this workforce, is that, what, 5 years? Is that until everything's built and then you can rent it to everybody? How long is that? And really, $26,000, that's $12 an hour. That's not a lot of money. And people work really hard for that, and they deserve to have a place to live, but you can't call it workforce. That's still not a lot of money. The other question is if any studies have been done about aging in place, because we have an aging population, people are living longer than ever, and older people don't live in apartments. They can't do it. They can't get up to the second or third floor. Ranch condos like they're doing at the Village Green, that's a great idea, because then you can live with the amenities of having a condo association, but you also can maybe live into that place until you're older. So that's another idea that I wanted to just bring up. And then I think, finally, my last comment is, there was a really great article, if you guys didn't see it, on the Village Green Center in Biz Times, which was wonderful and exciting about all the things happening in Pleasant Prairie. And it says in here that there's 120 acres available for development, multifamily, commercial, blah, blah, blah. So I guess my question to you is, would you let him build those apartments in the Village Green space? Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak?
Good evening. My name's Kirk Decker, and I live at 6218 92nd Place. I want to thank that one gentleman. He really touched on a lot of the points I was going to bring up. But mostly, I just initially want to just talk about the purchase of the property. Bear bought the property, the plan was in place. It had a circle drive. The bridge was part of the plan. So this should have been part of their due diligence to come back and cry poor mouth. We have to get apartments in here because we can't afford to build a bridge. The bridge was part of the plan. So that maybe goes to their due diligence before purchasing the property. I was one of the first home builders, my wife and I, a lot of the condo people. When we were presented a plan by Mastercraft and we were out there looking for places to build, we were given that community plan that was single-family homes, condos, but all of it was homeowners or owner-occupied. There was no rentals in the neighborhood. So in some ways, I feel for this to be even moved on from this body to the board is somewhat of a betrayal of what the community plan was at the time when that community was put together. So that's that. I brought a couple of studies, and these weren't just hacks from the Internet. This is something from Realtor.com, and is dated March 18th, 2016. And it talks about the 10 worst draws on home values in a neighborhood. The first, or worst, we'll say the worst draw, was bad schools at 22%. The number 9 was a strip club at 14.7%. The number 8 was high renter concentration, and that was at 13.8%. And then it moves on to homeless shelters, cemeteries, funeral homes, and power plants. What a coincidence. So that was that. I pulled up some more research, and this came from the Harvard Kennedy School, and this is on media politics and public policy. And their study was done from 1976 up until current time. This study was in 2015 when it was finalized. And it specifically talks about low-income housing tax credits and its effect on neighborhoods. They've seen adverse effects on neighborhoods in cities like Charlotte, North Carolina. They've seen positive effects on property tax values in places like Cleveland. And what the study mostly talks about is where do you start at with these type of plans? I would hand it to Bear. They're redoing that factory between 60th and 52nd along 22nd Avenue, that old factory there. So that's an example of where this type of, they don't want to call it subsidized, but it is rent controlled. The very definition of rent controlled is a government body dictating the amount of rent that you can charge. So if a person's making $2,100 a month, we know it's $25,000 a year. That is just slightly above the poverty level in Kenosha County, just slightly above what's deemed as the poverty level. So when you do developments like on 22nd Avenue there, that's in a neighborhood that the city's always had trouble with. There's a lot of landlord homes there. The homes that were single-family homes or duplex at one time, and now they're landlord homes. And you can drive through that neighborhood, and you can tell which one are landlords. Garbage in the yards, unkept, plywood on the windows. So that development right there has a positive effect on that neighborhood. It's going to bring up that neighborhood. It's going to give housing for people that are probably living in some of those poor houses there. Where it had the adverse effects were in developed neighborhoods. Like I said, the one study was Charlotte, North Carolina. It reduced their property values by 5.4% when they stuck these in those neighborhoods. So nobody wants to come out here and say, hey, I'm against the guy that only makes $12 an hour. Nobody wants to say that. I made $12 an hour, and when I did, I lived in a $12 an hour apartment in a neighborhood, an apartment community, I'd say. So what really is happening with this plan is they're just forcing an apartment community within owner-occupied community is what they're doing. So we were a bit excited back in 2015. I brought the meeting minutes before this commission, August 10th in 2015, when the proposal was to not do the condos or the duplexes, which actually those are very nice. I have to say I work in construction. We do a lot of work in condo communities and stuff, and I have to say that the people at the Creekside Crossing Condo Association do a fantastic job at taking care of their neighborhood, probably more so than some single-family homeowners do. So there was some excitement when Bear was proposing to, you know, finish it up but just put single-family homes in there. Now, the homes that were being proposed then or being proposed now don't match up with the size that were in our homeowners association when we built our house there. There were much stringent rules. If you had a ranch, it was 1,800 square feet on the first floor. If you had a two-story, it was, again, a 1,200 square foot footprint, but 1,800 square foot for the home. So with these homes, we've deviated from that. They're much smaller in square footage. So I'm just going to just pull up a few things from that meeting on October 10th, 2015. One of the citizens had concerns about drainage, and drainage is a big deal. I'm a landowner to the north. Bear did come to me to purchase some of our property to extend this into it, but just like with some of the other ones, I want to comment, that was a steal. $500,000 was a steal. No development is a slam dunk, but they certainly started at the free throw line. They got a piece of property well under market rate. It already had a footprint in place. It isn't like the Village Green project where it's a cornfield now. There's a lot of infrastructure that goes into there. To make this thing not work, I almost have to laugh when I hear, to make this a win-win, they need the subsidies and they need the apartments. I'm in construction. We're working on apartment complexes like this within the village that they're paying full freight. They're not subsidizing them. They paid for the land, full value of the land, and they're doing the same type of development, but they're doing them in an apartment community. They're all apartments that are going into those communities. And we have plenty of zoning within Pleasant Prairie for apartments too. All that development in Highway 8, so there's apartments going in everywhere. I don't know, and we've, again, done a lot of the construction work over there. I don't know that those got subsidies or needed subsidies. They didn't need them. They just built them. They're getting market rate. They're saying that these apartments are going to be somewhere at market rate. And what do they need the subsidies for if they're going to rent them out at market rate? But going to the drainage issues, and this is one of the things I think that, and this is for Mr. Polakoff. He says, okay, well, you know, we all know that Mashcraft went underwater. But, and this was for the single family homes now. But as this change in development occurs, they're significantly downsizing in the number of units that are going to be taking place versus original design, which will have, in turn, a significant impact on stormwater. There will be more green areas in this, and the developer is proposing no more than in the original development. So I guess what he's saying in there is that when they switched from having all the condos in there and they went to single-family homes, the footprint, there was going to be more green space, there was going to be less issues with stormwater, and then it goes further on in here, which is a big concern. Tom Turwell was on the commission, I think, at the time. He says, as a condo owner myself, I share your concerns with owner occupancy. Somebody, citizen, had spoke about owner occupancy. And that's the best way to go ahead. Just don't have rentals, period. And then somewhere in here, he mentions to Mrs. Werby Harris, Gene, can you make sure that that happens? And what he's asking her to make sure that happens is that if they do build condos in there, to make sure that they can't go rental. And that is an ordinance, and that's in the condo association's bylaws, too. So somebody has a condo, they did well, they want to move to Florida, but they don't want to lose their investment, they can't rent that out. It's right in it for any kind, any in and all. Not for cash, not for favors, not for trips. They can't do it. So this really flies in the face of all the investors in the neighborhood to put this in our neighborhood. And also, I only bring up the commission from meeting from the 2015 because I'm going to remind the commission that at that time they were making sure to be opposed to having any rental units in this neighborhood. And that they enjoyed the idea of a smaller footprint, more green spaces, and Karen, there was going to be a park on that end of the subdivision. That's that. I just want to bring a few things that came out of the recent Kenosha news. In Friday's newspaper, and there's not much left of the Kenosha news, to be honest, anymore, so you really got to look hard to find some news in it. It says, 2018, a boom for county job seekers. To attract some of the talent they need, an increasing number of employees have begun offering bonuses and even increased wages and benefits. Last year ended with many cities and counties reporting record, near record, unemployment rates. Kenosha was among 9 cities that set record for the lowest unemployment rates. Health, we're lucky here in Pleasant Prairie. Everybody knows it. We're a sweet spot. That's exactly why a lot of us are here. I can tell you that's why I'm here. Healthcare will be hot. We've got a new hospital being built out there with Aurora. We see the freighter doing the addition on the St. Catherine's Hospital. We see Freighter doing the 4-story MOB over here, and there's plenty of other, maybe not within our community, but around Kenosha. We get a lot of the Zumi clinics, and you know, healthcare is crazy. Okay, it says the healthcare industry is expected to be hot. Healthcare professionals topped the list of most in-demand jobs in 2019. The Bureau of Labor Statistics expects there will be a 47% growth in home healthcare jobs through 2024. And it just goes on about all the hot jobs, and then we've got a great base for those hot jobs. So that was Friday's newspaper. Saturday's newspaper comes out and says, local real estate market is a tale of two realities. Real estate sales professionals sold 2,240 homes in Kenosha County last year, 25 more than they sold in 2017. But just moving further down, this is the third strongest market since 2007. A lot of us were around in 2007. The housing market was hot, especially across the border in Illinois. I mean, these things were flying off the wall. Sluggish sales, he noted, are one of the byproducts of a diminishing inventory of houses to sell in Kenosha County. Shortage of single-family homes in Kenosha County is the biggest draw on our real estate market. We could fill this neighborhood with owner-occupied single-family homes and meet the demand. There's plenty of apartments. They're all over the place. So that's that. I want to just one last thing. I just want to talk about the, as soon as I seen it, the estimated values of these homes when they're built. What I did is I simply used the Kenosha County site. I went to every, now I'm a single family homeowner, so I didn't do anything with the condos, but I went to every, hit every tab on every single family home in this neighborhood. I'm going to back up. When we did our pre-construction with our bank before we built our house, and I'll just be honest, our house has the most square footage of any single family home in the neighborhood. Our pre-construction dollars were $450,000. We said, great. We bought the lot for $85,000. We had exclusively used MasterCraft. I could have saved some money if I didn't have to use them as a builder. So that was $450,000. We built that house. We paid $85,000 for the land. We paid $300,000 for the construction. We were $60,000 upside down. We were never anywhere near the $450,000. Even with the large increase in my property assessment from this last reassessment period, I mean, it went up $40,000, but I'm still only at $345,000. I have the largest house, 25,000 square feet on one floor and 25,000 on the second floor. And I work in construction. So I know a lot about construction. Where do you come up with $400,000 to $525,000 for each single family house when they're not anywhere near the sizes of the houses that were built when we had the homeowners association and they drove the size of the houses, the type of shingles, the colors, all this to it. So that's just bad information. And maybe they are selling them over there by St. Cats, but I doubt that. I doubt that. Community plans, due diligence, and rent control. So now we're proposing to fill our neighborhood with rent control. That's an old term from the 70s, isn't it? That's an old term from the 70s. Nobody wants to use the word subsidize, so we use different words to candy coat what the proposal is. And I think that's it for me. But I would ask the commission, though, to not let it go a step further than tonight. There's just no need. There's too much opposition to it. When Mr. Mills talks about a win-win situation, there's only going to be one winner in this room. It's not going to be the homeowners. Our investment is going to go backwards again. We finally are gaining some ground. And if when we first built our house and we were shopping around and they didn't have a master plan that said, this is what we're going to do, if they would have laid on the table and said, hey, but in 10 years from now, we're going to put rent-controlled, low-subsidized housing in your backyard, I doubt a lot of us would have built houses there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Jeff.
Jeff Sorensen, 6299 92nd Place. Gene, if I say anything that's not correct, interrupt me. When Creekside Crossing initially began, it was required of MasterCraft that this was owner-occupied, no rentals. MasterCraft then went out of business. The Creekside Crossing Condominium Association is now in charge. In the documents, no rentals. This is not a place for rentals. This is owner-occupied. I don't think there'd be a person in this crowd that would be against condos or single family, owner-occupied. Another thing to take into consideration, if you look at the plan, there is no other apartment location in the village that you drive through a single-family neighborhood to get to an apartment complex. You should be coming off of a main road, such as Highway H, Highway 50. There's a big plot of land on the south side of 93rd Street. Be a perfect place for apartments. They don't have to worry about bridges. Just put your apartments in. Big tract of land. Another thing that you need to consider, when you look at this plan, if you've driven down Old Green Bay Road, because now this is going to be a main access, picture yourself coming out of the complex and turning south to get to 31. If you know how Old Green Bay Road makes a hook before it gets to Dabbs Farm Road, I'm on Dabbs Farm Road Monday through Friday, which are work days, at approximately 7:15 to 7:30. The traffic is backed up at the stoplight at Green Bay Road. How is anybody going to get onto there to get onto Green Bay Road? They'll be backed up. If there's four cars to go straight across Green Bay Road to go to the Recplex, you're in the right-hand lane. Four cars, you can't get into the right-hand turn lane. There's a left-hand turn lane. How are you going to get out of there? If you go north on Old Green Bay Road and you hook to get to 85th Street, if you've ever noticed the traffic coming off of Green Bay Road onto 85th Street, how are you going to get out of there? Especially if you want to go west. Not going to happen. It's a bad layout. It's not appropriate for apartments. And like I said, owner-occupied. We were always told that at the last plan commission meeting when the iteration was all single-family, I spoke and said, owner-occupied, no apartments. That's correct, no apartments. Here we have apartments. Don't let it happen. I highly suggest you table this until it's further reviewed. Thank you.
My husband says I'm short. I guess I am. I'm Madeline Wirch. My husband and I live in Creekside condos on 8934 62nd Avenue. Our backyard is on that beautiful pond in the northeast corner, the upper left corner of your map. I am very disappointed in Bear Realty, not unexpectedly so, because 3 or 4 years ago, when we met with them, we were told that opposite that pond would be single-family homes, and that would be fine. Then in October, we had a meeting, and we were told that there would be four apartment buildings and two garages on that pond, you know. And that's a concern, and it's more concerning now because they moved three apartment buildings that were supposed to be in the southwest corner, and they moved the two by Old Green Bay Road, and then they gave us a fifth apartment building with a third garage building. And it's so beautiful out there, and to have to look at these large buildings, it's really unacceptable. But I have a concern because on the map that we were sent, we were told that Bear was going to make sure that water runoff would go to new retention ponds because we have to maintain that large pond. And on the map, it's a very small pond, which is now going to have to serve an extra apartment, five apartment buildings. And I ask you to consider that, and also because they're adding one more. I have a question about the duplex, the side-by-side, which will be on the cul-de-sac at the end of 62nd Avenue. And it will look supposedly like our condos. And is this going to be owner? Is it going to be part of our condo association or not? That's another concern I have. And all these other people brought up so many things that we all are concerned about. Thank you so much for listening to us.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak? Yes, sir. Yeah. You're giving your round of applause. You haven't even approached the podium yet.
My name's Warren Denhartog. I live at 9203 62nd Court. So why did I move to Pleasant Prairie? I worked for the city of Kenosha at the time. I wasn't allowed to live outside of the county. My wife worked in Illinois. So we landed a place here in Pleasant Prairie. We had money down at a Strawberry Creek area. We chose Pleasant Prairie. I don't like to shovel snow. Please don't add sidewalks to my neighborhood. That's the reason. I want to be able to have an outside fire. That's a reason. I want to have the best, and I work for a different police agency, the best police agency around Pleasant Prairie, award-winning. Best fire around. Sorry, Chief, about the police thing, but it's the truth. Those are the things that, why I moved here. And I moved here with the intent of what was supposed to be. But now all of a sudden, we're adding apartments. And like Jeff and the other gentleman said, apartments are what we do not want. Doing the job that I do, I know that apartments bring a lot of crime. They bring a lot of people in a small area, which leads to a lot of crime. And while we're speaking of crime, there's been nobody's talked about what's called CEPTED, crime prevention through environmental design. There's no talk about lighting. There's been no talk about police and fire access. There's been no talk about traffic control. There's been no talk about Americans with Disabilities Act, how someone disabled is going to get to a second floor apartment. There's been no talk about crime statistics. Those are the things that I'd like to hear before apartments come in to my neighborhood. And while it looks so far away on the map, I walk my dog to the corner and back, and obviously it's not that far if you look at my stomach. It's really not that far. So why do we want sidewalks? You know, people said to me, geez, Mr. Denhartog, it sounds like you're a NIMBY guy, not in my backyard. Well, you know what? As Pleasant Prairie people ask, do we want strip clubs in our backyard? No. Do we want crime in our backyard? No. Do we want things that can lead to that in our backyard? No. So I believe what the other people said here is true. We'd be more than happy to have owner-occupied residences. We'd be more than happy to have homes that are $500,000 plus. And by the way, if that's the case, mine will be up for sale for that amount. June 30th, when the kids get out of school. And I don't know, this isn't what I bought into, and I feel like, you know, I'm kind of taking it in the short end. No different than, well, I won't get into politics, but no different than what happened to different people when different administrations came in. So, again, I just ask you guys to reconsider that, and I do thank you for what you do, because this is an environment that I chose to live in, and I can choose to live somewhere else if it doesn't work out. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak? Anybody else wishing to speak? We'll close the public hearing. Let me just make a comment. I appreciate how everybody approached that podium with professionalism and respect, and it's not always the case from us sitting up here that we get that. So I appreciate that. It shows that you care, and believe me, this commission cares, the staff cares, this village cares. So we'll try and make whatever we have to do to make this thing work. So with that, who wants to answer some of the questions? SR, Gene, who wants to lead it off?
Well, I'll start by introducing SR, but I just want to comment on a couple of things. First of all, every development in Pleasant Prairie, when it's brought to us, we look at it from an accessibility standpoint, from a police and fire perspective. We would require any of the buildings in this particular development to have full fire sprinklers. I mean, these are all different things of community benefits, such as the camera system for security. So we really spend a lot of time in looking at building layouts, turning radius, with the fire lanes. We look at all of those things, and we have for many, many years to make sure that these aren't developments that are not going to be able to be serviced by Pleasant Prairie and our police and fire departments. So that's one thing that we do look at very, very closely, whether it's this development or any of the other developments in the village. A couple other things I wanted to point out, and then I'd like to, like I said, introduce SR up here, is that one of the things that we had talked about is that, yes, there is no northern park as we had originally had identified. So for there were two different things that we looked at as a staff. Number one, at the very north corner of the park, the northeastern corner, we had identified and worked with Bear to create a green space, and they were going to create a dog park up in that area. Again, it's not a traditional park as you'd see with children, but it would be for animals, dogs, to be able to run around and do their thing up there. So that was one element that we had looked at for park and open space. And then the second thing that we had mentioned to them is that we wanted to see them put some additional playground equipment in the existing park. And then a third element related to all of this was to try to interconnect Creekside existing as well as the new Creekside with basically sidewalks. It's something that as a village we've looked at over the years, but in the last 2 to 3 years we've been looking at a lot more closely. I don't know that we've made final decisions on anything with respect to sidewalks, but we know that, for example, in our Village Green or downtown, even just the minimal sidewalks that we've put in up to this point throughout the village, they have been used very very much by a lot of the residents who live here, as well as anybody who comes to the area that wants to do some walking. So I think that we have not made any final decisions on the sidewalks, but I think we do need to make some strong policy decisions on this development and any other development as we move forward with respect to the sidewalks. Again, just like the few sidewalk areas that we do have, it would require that the abutting landowners or association would be required to maintain them. The village isn't going to be maintaining sidewalks or snow plowing them. So it's something that we have to look at very seriously if we're going to require them in this development or any other development in the village to bring people around the community. And again, we don't want to see any dead-ended sidewalks, but we want to make sure that sidewalks interconnect. So that's why we're actually showing this interconnection along Creekside Circle, because we feel that having dead-ended sidewalks doesn't make as much sense as continuing the loop around a community or a subdivision or development. So that question has not been resolved yet. With respect to traffic, you know, whether this is apartments or condos or single family, it's still going to generate traffic. And we've looked at the interconnections of the roadways and so on and so forth. It doesn't warrant or justify any type of signals in this area. Depending on what happens with the Dabbs Farm property and some of the properties south, then a TIA would have to be done to reexamine those areas. But whether the housing type or the occupancy type is not going to determine whether or not additional apartments or condos are going to need signalization or people are going to wait longer to get in or out of their development. So, I mean, we've looked at that. We have looked at that since the 90s in this area, and I really don't know that that is something that is of grave concern. Again, as we continue the area to the south, I think that that is a concern, and we do need to take a look at transportation and whether or not there needs to be any additional lane movements or turning movements, but it wouldn't warrant a signal in this case. With respect to why the developer needs to have this multifamily interjected into this particular development, I'm going to let SR answer those questions. With respect to the trucking of fill, I think that that's another issue we do have to resolve, so sidewalks and the trucking of fill. The viability of the development, again, that's an SR question. With respect to the cost for development, costs for new construction, costs and costs for infrastructure construction, and our engineer can respond to this, but it's pretty close to $1,000 a foot for infrastructure construction. And in this case, there's a bridge, which is probably $750,000. So just so that everyone understands, to put in new single-family homes right now, that cost is nowhere near $30,000. That's what it was 30 years ago. Now it is closer to $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, a lot. Just so that everyone understands that to do this as just single-family would probably not, there wouldn't be enough funding from the developer in order to complete Creekside Circle and 91st to do it as single-family. That's why he stopped 3 years ago, because of the costs involved. So I just want to make everyone aware that I know what they would like to see, but just so that we know, maybe the market's not strong enough yet because of the fact that single-family lots are going for $110,000, $120,000, $130,000, and that is just the land. It's nothing else. So the costs are significant, and then, again, Matt can probably back me up on a lot of this based on what we're seeing for infrastructure costs. It's not inexpensive to do single family. If it were, we'd have a lot more single family developments under construction in the village, because we now require concrete roads. We've changed our standard. They're not a traditional asphalt road. They're concrete roads with asphalt overlay. And again, we're trying to do it to be a little bit more sustainable and to bring the overall costs of the village down for maintenance of public roads. So there have been a number of things that have changed from the village's perspective for infrastructure going in, and those costs, we pass all that on to the developers because we want that these roads and the infrastructure to last that much longer with less maintenance costs for the village overall. A couple other questions I'd like SR to answer is what gets built first? Would he build the apartments first or the single-family housing, and why does he need to do it that way? Could or would there ever be any changes with respect to rents? Could those rents go down? Would the rents only go up? How long would they stay with these rent restrictions? And so that's something else I think that I need to have him address. It is true that the initial phases, everything that was planned and constructed as part of the initial phases for the condominiums, the single family and the two family condominiums, those were always all intended to be owner occupied. I don't know what the ultimate goal, if that would ever change from Mastercraft. The original plan was all the expansion areas would be owner occupied, but we never got that far when the economy tanked. So I don't know what their ultimate goals were, if they were ever going to change that or not. But the initial plan did show this all as owner-occupied. We don't have any other developments. Someone had asked if we had any other developments where you go through single family to get to the back area or to another area where it's multifamily. No, we only have about 6 multifamily projects in the village right now. Cobblestone, Fountain Ridge, Hidden Oak, those are all on Highway H. Skyline, Cobblestone are also in the Prairie Ridge areas. So we've just started to explore multifamily in Pleasant Prairie, and we've been pretty successful with some very nice multifamily and very high-end multifamily in Pleasant Prairie. But we've had so many people also ask if there were any lesser price points to live in Pleasant Prairie in an apartment. If all the apartments rent at $1,200 above, we are minimizing the amount of residents that could come to our community there that are making a lesser wage. So we need to decide, is this the right location for them, or would there be another location in Pleasant Prairie that would be more suitable? And we are investigating all of those possibilities. What I can say is that the apartment, the look, the feel, the design, the architecture, the building materials, the use of sprinklers, the use of cameras, all of those things are in par with the other apartments in Pleasant Prairie, just so that you know. We're not scaling back on any of the architecture, the design of the materials, or the construction. So from that perspective, they would be the same as all the other units in Pleasant Prairie, the new ones under construction. But I think what we need to do is bring SR up, and I guess I would like to hear more of a case as why here, why now, why clustered in these locations? Could those rents change? And the cost that he actually knows his costs. We haven't seen all of that yet. Eventually, we would get all of that cost information because letters of credit and all the financial security and the contract documents and everything have to be presented to us so that we can draft development agreements and so on and so forth so that everything happens exactly the way he said it's going to as part of the approval process. Okay. But I'll let him start answering some of the other questions.
Yes, sir.
I believe I took some good notes here. So we got a handful of the topics. First, this relates to the traffic Gene mentioned early on. I think it's comparable. So I believe that what we're looking at now versus the original plan, traffic's really on par. The park improvements also alluded to, we have some flexibility there. We don't want to have parks for the sake of having parks where they're not used. We want to ensure that we have the right kind of parks and the right kind of open space. That is something as we talk about this plan and why we think it's a good fit. We do have a lot of open space. We have a lot of green space. We have and we're trying to create high-quality space that people can use. Oftentimes people just don't want it necessarily a small, whether it's a neighborhood park or a smaller area that really doesn't get utilized. Sidewalks we think are a good idea. I fully appreciate everybody's comments here. Paying for it might be a different thought process as it relates to the ongoing maintenance, but we try and make it as livable as possible and incorporating neat spaces. The pond areas and the stormwater, that is something, though, as we talk about the financial burden back to the association, we don't have water draining to the northeast to the pond that I believe was referenced behind the duplex product. The general stormwater flow goes to the southwest, and so it connects through hard pipe and swales, and I'd have to lean on our engineers, and Matt can maybe even comment to it, and we have some gentlemen here in the crowd, but I believe it works well from a stormwater. If there are any stormwater issues, typically when we have the pipe in the ground and we finish a development off, we alleviate those. We don't create more stormwater problems. We typically solve them, and so that's something that very confident that at the end of the day this would do. One of the questions was back to a property management and ownership. There's a mandate that we have to actually own this for 15 years with a lot of the things that we obligate ourselves to from a debt and equity standpoint. In reality, we don't sell our multifamily development. Anything can happen, and I understand that, but much like all of the product that we do, we're accountable for it. We're here for numerous developments, so we know you're only as good as your last deal, and we're accountable for who moves in, who stays in, and the upkeep from a look and a feel standpoint. Can the rents be lowered? So from the lower threshold on this is imposed by us, because if, much like any market rate development, at the newest one that was done behind the hospital, could they lower their rents? They could. That could also cause a default with their lender, and there's no benefit to lowering the rents. Now, why do people lower rents? So you hit it if you're in a downtime and you can't lease them, those rents start to fluctuate. Right now, we're certainly in a boom. I think that is one thing that we think this type of product is somewhat insulated against any significant downturns. While we might see them at the higher end, 1,800, 2,000, 2,500. If there's a dip in the market, we start to see some softness there. The product here between the 700 and 1,300 a month, we feel very good about that we don't see the softness in this type of product, specifically when we have waiting lists. That does a couple of things. One, it ensures that we get into tough times, we don't have to reduce our rents. The other thing it ensures is with waiting lists, we always have somebody that's willing to take that next unit. So if we have a bad actor, a bad citizen, if we have an issue with somebody, again, we are the first to evict them and get them out. Now, there's always problems. I mean, there's problems in condominium associations. There's problems in single-family subdivisions. There's problems in all kinds of communities. And it's really management and how you address it. And I think that we pay close attention to that. The village certainly does, too, with a lot of the policies and procedures. And nothing's ever perfect, but we're here and we're accountable to make sure it's really nice. And again, We stand by what we do. One of the questions goes back to the aging in place. This is considered this isn't an age-restricted development, but as it goes back to the aging in place, we see a large percentage of seniors, retirees, widowers, etc., move into a rental product. My 100-year-old uncle in Peoria, Illinois, just moved in about 2 years ago to the first floor flat of a rental product. And that, I mean, it's, well, that's a bit of an extreme example given the age, that is absolutely indicative of who we see here. And so it'll be a mix of people in their 20s and people in their 70s and everything in between. And that's part of what makes a good community at different socioeconomic points. You know, I do take, I'm not big on the fear mongering, and I get a little up, you know, as we talk about low income. This isn't low income. And people can say it is, but it's not. And when we talk about strip clubs and crime and things like that, it's not this. And things like that can happen everywhere. You can always have crime. And certainly we have a large enough footprint that crime happens. We do everything we can to mitigate it. We work really hard. We have all the security systems. Again, we're very, very diligent. But I do take exception to saying that whether it's a two-bedroom that's owned as a condominium or as a rental, that we're going to have criminals in there. And it's not the case. But, again, I think that it will be a high-quality development. As we go back to the bricks and the sticks and the look and the feel, I think the staff does an exceptional job. And we look forward to having a great, great development that fits in well. One of the other questions goes back to the duplex, that one unit in the northeast corner. Currently, we could not have that product be part of the existing association given the state of Wisconsin condominium laws. So that would actually be a fee simple unit. So it would be two sides that would be owned, whether it's owned individually or owned by the same person, but it would not be part of the existing association. So we can't do that, unfortunately, with Wisconsin state law, but we would have it as a for sale product. Relative to the ADA and all of the other programs, the Americans with Disability Act, and we comply with all of that. We're diligent on it. There's a lot of details that still go into the construction documents and working with fire chief, the police chief. You know, we've had a lot of those preliminary discussions to make sure that, you know, we flush out as many of those issues as we can on the front end, but certainly there's further work to do in going through that. Jean, did I miss anything in my comments? Oh, yeah. So as far as the timing, the multifamily, so all of the infrastructure will go in at once. So it's $6 to $7 million worth of infrastructure that has to go in out of the box. And then the multifamily would start immediately. So there would not be a phasing with the 140 units. And the single family going down from the southwest, making the loop, the only part of the single family that potentially would be phased would be the two cul-de-sacs coming in from the east going to the west. But all of the infrastructure to get the traffic circulation, et cetera, would be completed. As far as the actual construction and going vertical with the single-family homes, right now, as alluded, that's really not a concern. We don't have too many vacant single-family subdivisions, but there's a lot of available lot product. I think it's probably a three-year absorption period, 3 to 4 year. I think we use those same numbers at Arbor Ridge, and we're probably going to exceed that. It'll be done quicker, but that's what we're anticipating right now. One of the other points was brought up just on the sale prices, and I do have some information here as to where we're at Arbor Ridge. Custom contracts, 4.25, 555, 540, 395, 494, 489, 457. So these are all deals that have been inked, and I do think it's very indicative of what we're going to have here from a single family standpoint.
Thank you, SR. Jean, anything else?
There were a couple of other questions regarding someone who was concerned about speeding on Creekside Circle. Any concerns with respect to speeding or traffic control, those really should be addressed directly to the police chief, and then he would take the appropriate actions, whether or not there's some type of speed control advice or monitoring device that gets put out there, or there's an officer that gets stationed out there to do something. But that should really be addressed directly with the police department, and whether it's currently or in the future, that's how we address it in all the new subdivisions and all the existing subdivisions in the village. Someone also asked a question about an 89th Street connection to the east in the neighborhood plan. It showed that there's a potential to connect 89th Street at the very northeast corner of Creekside, and then it would go all the way to the east towards 89th and then towards Cooper Road. Again, there's no immediate plans for that. Again, it's just at this point we have a neighborhood plan that outlines where it could possibly go and where possibly a connection could be made on the north side of the park to make that east-west connection from Cooper Road to this development. Again, it's based on willing property owners wanting to develop their land. The village isn't going to go in and put in each segment of that roadway. It's when and if those areas develop, then those connected pieces get put in. No different than Main Street, you know, going from Village Green all the way out to Old Green Bay Road. It's when those specific areas start to develop, that's when that infrastructure starts to be put in.
SR, there was a question regarding a comment that was brought up with duplexes along the pond and the change in landscape that they were originally had identified that they'd be seeing single-family lots. Can you just talk briefly kind of how you're addressing the backside of that pond?
Certainly. Site plan. So I think it's important to look at the proximity of where we're at with the multifamily buildings west of the pond, and also in relation back to the duplexes to the east. So certainly sensitive to obstructing views or having something that isn't a, no matter what the situation is, we don't want backyards facing each other where somebody's looking at somebody else's living room. So one of the ways that we're, regardless of the product, what we've tried to do is have a large berm that will extend on the west side of the pond. It will be heavily landscaped. So we don't want, just like the duplexes don't want to have anybody looking in, we want to create that separation there. And so we would look to have a 4 to 5 foot tall berm, but with significant greenery that would run up the balance of that side of the pond. And then we would actually have a walking path west of the berm that would lead back to the dog park up there to the north. And so that's a feature that we think it should alleviate any real concerns once it's up and constructed, that it would block any of those views. And also any lights. Is anybody with headlights coming in into the development, we want to ensure that those do not shine in the back of anybody's windows or would be a hindrance.
So, SR, why 140 units? Why did you look at that?
So we tried to, the main reason was to stay in line with the density that was already there. So, you know, when we looked at the 172 units that it was entitled for, we went back and said, okay, we don't want to do anything that's any more dense. So when we think about the number of bedrooms and the product and how is that going to work, we don't want to create any, we don't have any additional traffic issues that weren't contemplated originally. We want to try and make it better. We think that going from the 140 units, acquiring the additional land to the west, so it's not quite an apples-to-apples comparison because we do have additional land. But when we look at the 172 units compared to on the 58 acres, now I believe we have 150, just over 150 units with the inclusion of some single family. So trying to balance that out, the 140, we felt it fit well. We felt we could, again, keep that density comparable, where from a look and feel standpoint, when we look at the 8-unit building versus a 20-unit building here, the size is pretty comparable. You know, the 700 square foot one bedroom apartment, I believe we have 55% of the units here are one bedrooms. Only 10% are threes. The balance made up in twos. So when we look at the actual fit, it's not that different from a larger 8 unit condominium-type product. So we wanted to do something that fit well, decrease the density. We wanted to ensure it was walkable, and that it, and we created the buffer between the multifamily and the balance of the development.
So did you look at trying to put some of that multifamily more on the west side and splitting it up into three areas or four areas?
We did. And originally, within the first plan, as we see the single family that kind of goes from the southwest to the north, we had multifamily on that side. And some of the feedback was, well, there's more of a concern about the traffic going through Creekside Circle to the southeast. And so based on that feedback, this was something that came from the meeting at the Recplex, we thought it was appropriate and decided that, well, let's try and shift those buildings further to the west, closer to Old Green Bay Road. That way we could really alleviate any necessity that if somebody is going back to the south, there's no reason that they would want to go back through the development to enter and go to the southeast and then further to the east. So trying to lay it out to path of least resistance for homeowners, for anybody that lives there, any resident, we want to make sure we understand those traffic flows as best we can. So that was part of the reason that we shifted and pushed additional multifamily north and west.
Okay. So someone had asked a question. I'm not sure if you answered this. Who would be the leasing agents and who would be doing the evaluations and so on and so forth?
Yeah, we do all of that. So that's within our control. That's our company, part of the Bear Real Estate Group. We have strict criteria. We have all of that. We have to adhere to federal guidelines. There's equal housing, just like anybody has to. We certainly have to be consistent with our restrictions. We are consistent. And so that's all done at our shop.
I'm not sure if there were any other
Thank
questions.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, comments and questions from the...
Yes, sir. Don't go anywhere.
Stick around. Jim.
Just out of curiosity, did you look at any other additional properties to like, for Gene's concerns, to split them up, the multifamily units?
You're talking within the site?
Yeah, or even a little bit off the site on Green Bay, like, say, north or south of what's proposed by the clubhouse?
We did, you know, and that's part of the reason that we actually acquired the additional 4 acres, too, is to be able to better push the density back and forth, get it to align properly, and be able to, we think, have it work well. We certainly looked at a lot of different sites to the north, to the east, to the west to try and get it all to align. We felt that this was a pretty good fit given the prior density and some of the traffic patterns, but we did look at a lot of different options. You know, again, we've been working on this one for about 6 years to try and find something that fit.
So going to the demographics, you're looking at pulling people from the working people that are working in the park, the industrial park?
This is the demographic will be, when we think about it, it's one bedrooms, two bedrooms, three bedrooms, smaller amount of threes. We did a bit of a study looking at the school-age children and comparable developments that we have. It's about one child for every six units. It's kind of what we've found. And I think it'll probably be a little less here because of we don't have a lot of two bedrooms and three bedrooms. Primarily what we're going to see, we think, are seniors. I think we will have quite a few seniors where somebody wants to age in place. They don't want to leave town after they retire because they can't find something that makes economic sense. We've seen that as a big push. And then we also see somebody that makes between, again, that $25,000 and $55,000 that when they're coming into the area, they don't want to maybe purchase a home yet. They don't know exactly where they want to be. And it's...
You're basically restricting the seniors to the lower level then. Am I correct?
Correct. And that's just part of having a two-story.
Hypothetically, say my 90-year-old grandmother wants the second floor.
It's
not going to happen.
Not going to happen. And that's all in line with the... ADA compliance. We have a great spot at, down the street where we'll have an elevator to accommodate them. It's just this will not be that type of development that would accommodate somebody with issues walking or stairs living on the second floor.
Okay. HR, how many first floor single bedroom units will you have? Because I'm going the same place. I mean, there seems like there's a lot of single bedroom units. I mean, very disproportionate, and I'm trying to go to, I think, where Jim was going as far as if you're thinking that your population is going to be elderly, how are you managing
that? And I don't think it's going to be elderly either. I think we're going to have a mix. And so I want to make sure I don't overemphasize the fact that we will have seniors, because I think it's something that, as we talk about aging in place, that is something that we will accommodate here, and we will have some of that. But the majority, probably 70 to 80%, will be from 25 to 60 years old. So when we look at the floor plans, the first floor is all the way to the top. We have a combination of, we've got primarily two bedrooms. We've got a couple of one bedrooms there too. So it's a mix between the twos, ones, twos, and threes on both the first and the second floor. And what we've tried to do, and this is, it's more art than science. We have a big portfolio to choose from to try and figure out those percentages of the one bedrooms, the two bedrooms, and three bedrooms. We're always tweaking it, and we're always trying to make the product better. We feel very good that this product will lease. We're talking 140 units. And the way that we would look to have this absorption work over time, we typically deliver about one to two buildings a month. So we think it would, we found that the other developments, it works well, and this is a pretty good mix. There was concern we heard early on about having too many three bedrooms with having too many kids. So we tried to limit that a little bit as well. And so we're trying to find that balance in here. Yes, sir.
So I guess there's a HOA in place for the current owners, right? So the apartments, the 720 units, is that going to have any HOA to it?
No, it would not. So one of the, again, this really goes back to that state of Wisconsin condo law, because there was such a gap from when the original development was platted and the association took place. If it's over a decade, we could not join that association even if we wanted to. Okay. So really, it is completely separate and distinct. Now, it was platted going back to the village process of here's the condominium plat. But as far as that association is concerned, it's separate.
So even the new single families will be a new HOA?
That's correct.
Okay.
I have another question related to kind of from a bear management perspective. You were talking a little bit about that if you've got a problem resident or renter, whatever you want to call them, they're quickly dealt with and evicted. What's your eviction rate, and how does that compare to other property management companies?
Our eviction, I don't know our eviction rate. From the standpoint, though, that we're being local and being, we have developments in other areas and other states as well, and we certainly see outside REITs and private equity groups that have developments here. I know from a management standpoint that we have a centralized office platform, which means that we have a main office. We're located here in Kenosha area. Now, we also have on-site managers at each one of these developments, but it's a little bit different where if we owned a random development in Georgia and we had our development or property management company down there, it's really one office, one person dealing with that. So we do have some additional backup here because it's part of a central office management.
So for that, for the group that is here managing it, do you know how you compare to other organizations?
I know that right now we have a 98.6 occupancy rate. So we have one of the highest occupancy when you look at from southeastern Wisconsin to the state. We have significantly higher occupancy. Now, that could mean a couple of different things. One, we could have happier tenants that just want to stay longer and we have less turnover, or it could be that it could mean a variety of things, but it is one of the main barometers that we've looked at, that over time, if we continue to have higher than average occupancy, it means that people are generally happier. We do a lot of surveys, and we know that it's tough to pull back exact data about our eviction rates. You can get good tenants and you can get bad tenants, and it's That is definitely more art than science. I can tell you, though, that if we fully understand that if you get a bad tenant, it is poison in a development because they will drive good tenants away. And unlike a condo association where all of the rules and regs are individual, we still have a lot of control. Now, we have to follow federal, state guidelines, et cetera, with how we evict. But we do we are very, very diligent on that because we've seen developments. We've come in on turnover or turnaround deals where others have kind of screwed things up in the past, and we've stepped in to try and rid problem tenants and go through that. And it's tough. So we want to make sure there's an ounce of prevention, pound of cure scenario going into it, that we do our best to make sure that bad tenants don't take root in there and we get them out so we don't lose good tenants.
Anybody else? Brock?
So the density that you're proposing, is that the only way to make this work?
It is.
Okay. Yeah. It's same thing with apartments?
Yeah. It was a bit of a sweet spot where we try to find that balance. We try to look at it from a good land use plan standpoint, too, to say, okay, what's going to fit within the Creekside Circle? How do we get that density to fit, to balance with the existing development, to balance with what was platted before, and to have it work?
Do you have any WIDA other buildings under your control?
We do, many. We've done a lot of developments with various state housing agencies over the years.
Okay. Once that restriction of 15 years goes off, where do you see the rent amounts going?
Historically, they go up.
Okay.
They don't go down.
Anybody else? Well, this is a conceptual plan that we're looking at right now. I think the people have brought out good concerns, great concerns. Just a little background, if I could. Our community development director has been with the village for 30 years. I've been on the board for that length of time as John Steinbrink, Mike Polakoff. They're not here tonight. We've approved a lot of developments for the village. And I challenge anyone to point out a development that we failed on, whether it be commercial, industrial, or residential. Whether or not we approve this in the ultimate end, not tonight, whatever we do tonight, whether or not we approve this, the last thing this commission will want to do, or the board, was approve a development that's going to be negative on you. That's not what we're all about. And I think we have 30 years of proof standing behind that. I want somebody to point out where we have failed. We don't do that. Gene Worby Harris is a person that will stand up to big money and big influence, and that's a benefit to every one of us in this room. We can have developers come in here, just push us over. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. So have a little faith in our community development director and her staff, this commission, and the board. There's a lot of things that still have to be resolved, as far as I'm concerned, on tonight's meeting. Sidewalks is one of them. Maybe we can tweak some other things that people have brought up. But we're a part of this village as well. And we're not going to give you a bad product. That's not what we're about. With that, look for a motion on item C as 1905. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I realize that this is a tough thing to go over, and I really have faith in Gene and the staff and working towards a good relationship with everybody and the village. I don't want to stop this process. And with that, I would recommend it moving forward, subject to working with Gene and getting everything addressed.
G, Gene, just for clarification, tell the audience how many more meetings will take place before this become final.
So there's multiple steps in the planning process. The initial step would be tonight before the Plan Commission that deals with the neighborhood plan and a conceptual plan. The next meeting, it would go to the Village Board for them to evaluate the same thing, the conceptual plan and the neighborhood plan. The next step for the developer would be to put together the detailed engineering plans and to bring back a preliminary plat, and that would involve a public hearing as well before the Plan Commission, and then a meeting before the Village Board. And then the next step after that is the final plat, again, another public hearing before the Plan Commission, and then the Village Board. So traditionally, there's at least six meetings, three before Plan Commission and three before the Village Board, where all of the other details are ironed out, vetted out, concerns are addressed with respect to the legitimacy of the plan. Okay. The key is that, you know, there needs to be some direction given to the developer by the Plan Commission and by the board in these initial steps as to whether or not he continues to move forward, or are there some things that just need to be tweaked or adjusted or removed or added to, and that this would be the time to kind of address some of those other things as we start to continue to refine the project as we move forward.
Okay. I strongly suggest that we work together with SR and Mills and address some of the concerns that some of the people have here. I think they're legitimate. I think we can adjust. We can probably maybe make some adjustments here and there that will make this a little bit more easy to accept. Sidewalks being one of them, sounds like they don't want them. A couple of things that were brought up. Just let's work on this thing and see if we can just make it acceptable to everybody. So, is that a motion on your
side? I would make a motion for the resolution of 1905, send a favorable recommendation to the board.
Second?
Second.
Motion made and seconded for approval of resolution 1905. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. Item D, public hearing consideration of a conceptual plan. This is a conceptual plan. There's many more steps before this becomes final.
Could be a lot of changes. With that, I would recommend approval.
Second.
Motion made and seconded for approval of the conceptual plan. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay.
Item E, the public hearing and consideration of a floodplain boundary adjustment. Matt? Jim, who's got that? Gene? I called item E already. Item E.
Okay.
Item E is public hearing in consideration of a floodplain boundary adjustment for the request of Matt Feinauer, village engineer, on behalf of the village of Pleasant Prairie for proposed culvert replacement crossing of a tributary to the Des Plaines River, which is located on an access road to the Pleasant Prairie Residential Recycling Center, located at 8128th Street.
Excuse me, Rockwell, could you go to the back of the room, please? Thank you.
The village is proposing to replace culverts under the existing driveway access to the residential recycling center at 8128th Street and to add additional pavement layer to the roadway. These culverts allow for floodplain waters to flow under the access driveway. For information, this access driveway is proposed to be dedicated as a public street known as Greenway Court as a condition of Prairie Produce Farm development. The culvert's replacement and additional pavement layer will not amend the location of the 100-year floodplain boundary, but the hydraulic analysis shows that the modification would increase the 1% annual chance event water surface elevation by 0.20 feet on the downstream side of the culverts, the west side of the roadway, about 10 feet west of the culvert on the village's property within the existing 100-year floodplain, as further outlined in the attached hydraulic analysis dated November 28, 2018. As a result of this water survey elevation increase, a floodplain boundary adjustment is required. The floodplain adjustment is consistent with the purposes of Section 42131 of the Village Zoning Ordinance and is not in conflict with the applicable rules of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources or the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Permits would be obtained from the Wisconsin DNR and FEMA prior to the proposed work commencing, and when the work is required, a letter of map revision or a LOMER will need to be obtained. After the LOMER is obtained, public hearings to correct the zoning map and the zoning text would be held. This is a matter of public hearing. The village engineer is here if you would like to hear any further explanation or comment with respect to the request.
It's a matter for public hearing. Anybody wishing to speak? Anybody wishing to speak? We'll close the public hearing and open up to comments and questions. It's your pleasure.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend approval.
Second.
Motion made and seconded for approval of a floodplain boundary adjustment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the ayes have it. Item F, public hearing and consideration of an amendment to the Village Land Division and Development Control Ordinance. Jane?
The village staff is recommending that Section 395.72G of the village's Land Division and Development Control Ordinance be amended to clarify that all public and private sanitary sewer mains shall be designed and constructed to provide gravity basement service. Further, new residential homes and units shall be connected with gravity basement sewer service unless approved by the village engineer based on a practical difficulty or an unnecessary hardship. This clarification would allow for existing lots that have municipal sanitary sewer within the adjacent street to have hung plumbing or an ejector pit if the existing sanitary sewer cannot provide for gravity basement sewer service. Again, we had a strong provision in the Land Division Ordinance that something shall be this way with respect to the sanitary sewer. In some cases, sanitary sewer was put in many years ago, and based on its depth or the soils, it made it very problematic and almost financially impossible for connections to be made to that sewer, especially on 116th Street where the soils were so poor. So we wanted to work in some flexibility into the Land Division Ordinance and give that flexibility to the village engineer so that on a case-by-case basis, if in fact there's some unique circumstance that would prevent that connection and require hung plumbing or an injector pit or some type of grinder pump, if you will, that they would be allowed to approve of it as opposed to a variance being obtained by the resident from the village board from the land division ordinance. So.
Okay. This is a matter for public hearing. Anybody wishing to speak? Anybody wishing to speak? We'll close the public hearing, open up the comments and questions. Don't we already have provisions in place for grinder pumps at, in areas that?
No.
We don't?
No, not really, no.
On 47th Avenue, we have a couple homes out there that have grinder pumps.
Right. As Peggy is reminding all of us, we had variances that needed to be granted. Special exceptions or variances were needed to be granted by the village board. And we want to not have to bring those situations again back to the village board each time and hold up the property owners from being able to pull permits and start their construction. We just feel that we have professional engineering staff that would review each situation on a case-by-case basis, look at the elevations, look at the home, and try to work with the property owners. Again, it's not typical because that's not how things are designed in Pleasant Prairie, but it does happen occasionally.
Would this be a good fix for Cooper Road, south of 80th?
Well, that's a little bit different situation because...
John, would that be what we're looking at?
It wouldn't help some of those homes in that area.
Okay. Okay. All right. Comments or questions?
I have none.
Okay.
I would recommend move for approval for the amendment to Section 395-72G.
Second.
Motion made and second for approval of the amendment to the Village Land Division and Development Control Ordinance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those ayes have it. Adjournment.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
Motion made and second to adjourn. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those ayes have it. Thank you, people.